raise up and take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution.
This Week in Radical History for the week starting October 13th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, more radical info was found at the Daily Bleed website, and some audio segments are being borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York.
There is something going on in the East Side.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This Week in Radical History for October 13th, 1855. In Grenada, William Walker takes a private army into Grenada to overthrow the government on this date. Walker runs around a lot of South America taking over governments here and there while passing laws to bring back slavery into fashion. Not surprisingly, he is supported by volunteers and supplies from the Southern Confederacy states. Walker is even recognized as president of Nicaragua by the U.S. president. Eventually would be captured and killed by a firing squad. Well deserved. Also on October 13, 1902, Teddy Roosevelt threatens to work the coal mines with federal troops if the strike does not end. Roosevelt was a mouthpiece for powerful industrialists in this country. He was quoted as saying, "The worst foe of the poor man is labor leaders, who tries to teach him that he is a victim of conspiracy and injustice." Economic philosophy of Teddy Roosevelt. Also on October 13, 1909, educator, rationalist, and founder of the public modern school system, Francesco Furer, is killed by Spanish Catholic monarchs. He was opposed to the influence of state religion and dogmas. He hated the Catholic Church monopolizing education in Spain, and they hated Führer. An anarchist militant and free thinker, he was blamed for the upheavals during the tragic week in July in Barcelona. After his execution, capitals throughout Europe, demonstrations are held protesting the execution of Führer. Violent confrontations between the protesters and the police occur in Paris, where over 500,000 people turned out, in Argentina, where 20,000 workers will have a general strike, which will last until October 17th. On the second anniversary, 2 years later, protesters continue in the anniversary of Führer's death. A professor at Columbia University in New York is fired for daring to share a platform with Emma Goldman as more Führer modern schools are opened up around the world. 5 years later, in 1914, multiple bombs are planted at churches throughout New York, and anti-anarchist sentiments increase, which will lead to things like the Palmer Raids. Also born on this date in 1925, Lenny Bruce, stand-up comic, social rebel, hounded to death by cops throughout his career, imprisoned on obscenity charges, as the shows are banned throughout England and Australia as well. Nightclub owners, fearing police harassment, begin refusing to book him, and his career collapses. Lastly, it's been recently revealed that on this date in 1970, the CIA paid Chilean military $20,000 to assassinate the duly elected president of Chile, Allende. This Week in Radical History for October 14th, 1864, the first African-American daily newspaper, the New Orleans Tribune, begins publishing in both French and English. Also on October 14, 1912, Teddy Roosevelt, campaigning in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, is shot at close range by anarchist William Schreck. Also on this date in 1985, Attorney General Ed Meese would be quoted as saying, "If a person is innocent of a crime, then he is not a suspect." So much for innocent until proven guilty. Also on October 14, 1994, commie folk singer Pete Seeger receives the 1994 National Medal of the Arts from President Clinton.
Fortunate to have back on our show a man who was on the first show of the season. He's a major influence on American music, and he's written such songs as "Where Have All the Flowers Gone?", "Turn, Turn, Turn," and with Lee Hayes of the Weavers, the song "If I Had a Hammer." And also such songs as "Michael Row the Boat Ashore," "On Top of Old Smoky," "Goodnight Irene," "Kisses Sweeter Than Wine," and "Weem Away" are just a few of the songs that he has introduced and kept alive through his singing. We're very proud to have this man on our show, not only because he's a great man, a fine man, and a great performer, but also because he performs rarely on television. In fact, he's only made one major television appearance in the last 17 years. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm happy to present on our show for the second time, Mr. Pete Seeger.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody's free. That's what the teacher said to me. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that policemen are my friends. I learned that justice never ends. I learned that murderers die for the crimes, even if we make a mistake sometime. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned our government must be strong. It's always right and never wrong. Our leaders are the finest men, and we elect them again and again. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that war is not so bad. I learned about the great ones we have had. We fought in Germany and in France, and someday I might get my chance. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
What was not mentioned in the intro you just heard is that the reason why Pete was not on the TV for 17 years was because he was blacklisted during a McCarthy hearing, witch hunts. And though the Supreme Court would rule in Seeger's favor years later, that he has the right not to discuss his political affiliations, he, like so many others, were still blacklisted for many, many years. When his mother's brothers bravely brought him back onto the airways, his song that he played on that show, The Big Muddy, was pulled from the show airways. The Smother Brothers protested, and he got him back on the show, and that was the intro you just heard. However, their show would also be taken off the air for insisting that Seeger be allowed back on the show to sing the song, The Big Muddy. Here's that controversial song by Pete Seeger.
It was back in 1942, I was a member of a good platoon. We were on maneuvers in Louisiana one night by the light of the moon. The captain told us to ford a river, that's how it all begun. We were knee-deep in the big muddy, the big fools had to push on. Well, the sergeant said, sir, are you sure this is the best way back to the base? Sergeant, go on, I forded this river about a mile above this place. It'll be a little soggy, but just keep slogging, we'll soon be on dry ground. We were waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on. Sergeant said, sir, with all this equipment, no man will be able to swim. Sergeant, don't be a nervous Nelly, the captain said to him. All we need is a little determination, men, follow me, I'll lead on. We were neck deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on. All at once the moon clouded over, we heard a gurgling cry. A few seconds later, the captain's helmet was all that floated by. The sergeant said, turn around, men, I'm in charge from now on. And we just made it out of the big muddy with the captain dead and gone. We stripped and dived and found his body stuck in the old quicksand. I guess he didn't know that the water was deeper than the place he'd once before been. Another stream had joined the big muddy about a half mile from where he'd gone. We were lucky to escape from the big muddy when the big fool set to push on. Well, I'm not going to plant any moral, I'll leave that for yourself. Maybe you're still walking, you're still talking, you'd like to keep your health. But every time I read the paper, them old feelings come on. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep, neck deep, soon even a tall man will be over his head. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on.
This week in Radical History for October 15th, 1892, The 1.8 million acres of the Crow Indian Reservation in Montana is opened by white settlers, forced proclamation issued by President Harrison. Also on this date in 1997, El Salvador, President Romero is deposed by the military coup. In February of 1981, the U.S. admits having sent 18 CIA advisors to help the military junta. Then, as in today, here's a brief report on U.S. intervention in the up-and-coming El Salvador elections, this segment from Latin Radical Radio.
You tell us a little bit about what the Minister for Foreign Affairs from El Salvador said last week in the United States.
Hi, Warwick. Very interestingly, after the recent discussions that the United States Solidarity Groups had in El Salvador with the ambassador from the United States to El Salvador, where the United States admitted its previous interference in internal affairs of El Salvador. This time around, the United States would not be looking at direct interference, or even indirect, if you like, interference that could be attributable to the United States in the coming Salvadoran elections. So when you then have the foreign minister of the nation, Marisol Argueta, going before the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., specifically asking for United States intervention. I guess that's put that ambassador in an interesting situation now with these comments by Minister Argueta, not just comments, but appeal for United States intervention. I mean, she specifically put to the United States, to the Conservative American Enterprise Institute in Washington, that the proposition that losing in El Salvador would be not just devastating for the security and national interests of the oligarchy within El Salvador, but also for the United States. A big call that she's put out there, you know, from one fascist right-wing government to the supporting interests in neighbouring imperialist United States.
It's deja vu all over again. More illegal, more moral U.S. involvement in South America. For on this date in 1984, the Associated Press reports the existence of a CIA-prepared terrorism manual advising right-wing Nicaraguan rebels how to blackmail unwilling civilians into supporting their cause, how to arrange deaths of fellow rebels to create martyrs, and how to kidnap and kill, or as the manual puts it, neutralize government officials. This manual was first revealed by the Baltimore Sun in January, but the U.S. media, including the Washington Post and New York Times, buried it for years.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, October 16th, in 1859, white American abolitionist John Brown led an attack on Harper's Ferry, a U.S. arsenal in Virginia. With a group of about 20 men, five of whom were black, John Brown attacked and captured the arsenal with the intention of distributing the weapons and inspiring a slave revolt throughout the South. Although they managed to get into the arsenal, the raid was short-lived because Southern citizens and militia soon cornered Brown and his followers. When the U.S. Marines arrived, they stormed the arsenal, killing many of the rebels. The rest of them were captured and eventually hanged, including John Brown. John Brown was the first white abolitionist in America to engage in an insurrection against the institution of slavery. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on October 16th, 1893, Emma Goldman is sentenced to Blackwell's Island Penitentiary for 1 year, her crime given a speech. In 1919, the Deportation Act to rid U.S. of anarchist aliens, thousands including Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman jailed and sent packing to Russia. Quoting Emma, "And you, are you so forgetful of your past? Is there no echoes in your soul of your poet's songs, your dreamer's dreams, your rebel's calls?" Emma Goldman. Lastly, for October 16th in 1998, Abraham Lincoln Brigade is honored. More than 60 years after they took up arms against the fascists of Spain, of which Hemingway romanticized them and the FBI files blacklisted them, members of the anarchist all-volunteer Lincoln Brigade had finally been given an official monument in this country, as U.S. nor England at the time would raise a finger to help fight the fascists. This week in Radical History for October 17th, I only have one item. In 1920, John Reed, American radical journalist, dies in Moscow at age 32, chronicled the Mexican and Soviet revolutions, wrote the book 10 Days That Would Shock the World. Reed is the only American buried in Red Square. For a good movie about his life and his run-ins with the character in the movie Emma Goldman, see the 1981 movie Reds, starring Warren Beatty. That is the movie Reds.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, October 18th in 1968, black American track medalists Tommy Smith and John Carlos were suspended from the U.S. Olympic team for publicly displaying the black power fist at the Mexico City Olympic Games 2 days earlier. As the American flag rose and the Star Spangled Banner played, both Smith and Carlos had bowed their heads and raised their fists to represent black pride and unity. The gesture had been inspired by a recent movement encouraging black athletes to boycott the Olympics in protest of the oppression that black people still faced in America, despite the efforts of the civil rights movement. The display of resistance enraged many white Americans who stated that Olympic Games were supposed to be apolitical. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. On this day, October 19th in 1849, Elizabeth Blackwell graduated from Geneva Medical College in New York, becoming the first woman in the United States to receive a medical degree. Elizabeth was originally born in England to a family that encouraged both their daughters and their sons to pursue a formal education. Upon moving to America, she joined the abolitionist cause as well as becoming an active women's rights advocate. After completing graduate studies in a London hospital, Elizabeth returned to the U.S., but finding herself barred from practicing in American hospitals, she established a medical clinic in New York for women and children. 10 years later, she founded a women's medical college there to train women physicians. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, little boxes all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all went to the university where they all were put in boxes, little boxes all the same. And there's doctors and there's lawyers and business executives, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. And they all play on the golf course and drink their martini dry, and all have pretty children, and the children go to school, and the children go to summer camp, and then to the university where they all got put in boxes and they all came out the same. And the boys go into business and marry and raise a family in boxes, little boxes, little boxes all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
You've been listening to more of Pete Seeger, and this has been This Week in Radical History, produced out of the Glee Glee Studios. Special thanks to the Radio Roots crew at WBAI, whose audio I borrowed. Thanks to the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website for a whole lot of radical info I use in the show, and the Slingshot organizer for the inspiration for this piece. A reminder what anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman once said: if voting never really changed anything, they would have made it illegal. So until next week's This Week in Radical History, I am forever yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Tell me, which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
My daddy was a miner, and I'm a miner's son. He'll be with you, fellow workers, until this battle's won. Tell me, which side are you on? Which side are you on?
See it!
Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Oh, workers, can you stand it? Tell me how you can. Will
you be a lousy scab or will you be a man? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Tell me which side are you on? Which side are you on? Come all of you good workers, good news to you I'll tell of how the good old Union has come in here to dwell. Tell me which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Tell me which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. What is going on politically concerning the governance of the West Bank and Gaza? What is its future? It is a question we have been asking recently on This Week in Palestine. And we begin this week with some insight into that question by Omar Karmi, a former Jerusalem and Washington, D.C. correspondent who wrote for the national newspaper. Here are excerpts from an article Karmi wrote recently that sheds light on what's going on politically in the West Bank and Gaza. Karmi writes, quote, "The latest crisis forced on Gaza by Israel and the Palestinian Authority has also produced unexpected side effects. Notably, it has prompted Hamas to cooperate with a previously bitter rival. The decision by Mahmoud Abbas, head of the Palestinian Authority, to suspend payments to Israel for electricity for Gaza was made back in April. That month, the Fatah-led occupied West Bank-based Palestinian Authority also decided to reinstate taxes on fuel destined for Gaza, leaving Hamas, which administers the coastal strip, unable to pay. This caused the shutdown of Gaza's only power plant, which was already operating at reduced capacity due to damage sustained in repeated Israeli bombardments over the past 11 years, and reduced the amount of electricity available to Palestinians in Gaza to 4 hours a day. April, clearly the cruelest month, also saw the PA slash funding to Gaza's hospitals and clinics, as well as put into effect a salary cut of between 30 to 70% to public sector employees who had hitherto been paid to stay home rather than work for a Hamas administration. but whose salaries have provided a vital stream of revenue in the impoverished Gaza Strip. The PA has long argued that Hamas has been diverting money from taxes for its own ends rather than pay for fuel. But the ultimate intention was clear and explicit. The PA was going to squeeze Hamas financially to secure concessions that would allow the West Bank leadership to regain some measure of control over Gaza 10 years after Hamas quelled a Fatah insurgency sparked by the Islamist movement's parliamentary election victory in 2006. Hussein Sheikh, head of the PA's Civil Affairs Committee, stated, "We are not going to continue financing the Hamas coup in Gaza." But this is a high-stakes gamble. Abbas is effectively prepared to look like he is making common sense with Israel against Hamas while playing politics with the welfare of 2 million Palestinians. He does so to no obvious end and offering no alternative. There is no peace process, and Israeli settlement building in the West Bank continues apace. If the PA president thought this was a way to curry favor with the U.S. administration of Donald Trump, a blazing row with Washington over welfare payments to families of prisoners, as well as the Trump administration's general unpredictability, should be paid to that notion. Moreover, two can play the enemy of my enemy is my friend game. Abbas may have hoped that there would be an uprising against Hamas in Gaza, but he surely couldn't have expected it. He may have hoped for a conflagration with Israel that would achieve what three previous all-out military assaults failed to do and dislodge Hamas from power. But that, too, would have been a far from certain outcome. And Israel has already said it does not want to be dragged into any such confrontation. What Abbas could not have foreseen, here's the law of unintended consequences, is an unlikely alliance between Hamas and Mahmoud Dahlan, the erstwhile Gaza security chief, sworn enemy of Hamas and long-standing Abbas rival, who was sacked from Fatah in 2011 amid corruption charges that were eventually dropped. But that is exactly what is happening. Earlier this month, Hamas publicly called for the establishment of a national rescue fund to challenge the PA and announced an agreement to cooperate with Dahlan. Meetings have already taken place in Egypt, and Dahlan is seen as instrumental in forging the agreement with Egypt. A leaked document publicized this week now suggests Dahlan could become the leader of Gaza's government under a secret agreement with Hamas. This is quite a turnabout for both parties. Dahlan was not just any senior Fatah official in Gaza. He was the senior Fatah security leader in Gaza in 2007 and instrumental in leading Fatah into conflict with Hamas after the latter had won parliamentary elections in 2006. The eventual insurgency was supported by the U.S. and was meant to nip Hamas rule in the bud. Much will depend on whether Egypt keeps up fuel deliveries and whether these can be both sustainable and paid for. But Cairo has its own interests. Egypt wants order in the Sinai, where it has been battling a self-styled Islamic State group for several years and believes Hamas can help. Hamas for some time has been keen to improve relations with Cairo, which operates the only crossing into Gaza not directly controlled by Israel. Relations had suffered dramatically after the military coup that ousted Mohamed Morsi, the democratically elected Egyptian president, in 2013, and saw Abdel Fattah al-Sisi seize power and then outlaw Morsi's Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. Notable in this context, but not much remarked upon at the time, was the publication earlier this year of a new Hamas charter that omits any mention of the wider Muslim Brotherhood. Instead, the document stresses Hamas's role as a national liberation movement and explicitly condemns any outside interference in Palestinian decision-making. In effect, the charter saw the Palestinian Islamist formally sever ties with the regional Muslim Brotherhood. Hamas needs international support. Its charter was a clear attempt at making the movement more acceptable to outside, but especially regional, actors. Qatar's current isolation makes this need acute. An alliance between Hamas and Dahlan opens the door for the United Arab Emirates, which hosts and supports the former Fatah official, to step into a breach that has hitherto been filled by Qatar's financial assistance. Moreover, the so-called Arab Quartet, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan, was frustrated by Abbas's refusal before last year's 7th Fatah General Conference to make nice with Dahlan, who appears to be the Gulf state's favored candidate to succeed Abbas, an octogenarian smoker. What that will mean for Hamas is not clear. What it means for Palestinians generally is also not obvious, though, as the Saudi-led Gulf Cooperation Council countries and Israel have been casting come-hither glances at each other, the signs are not propitious. What it could mean for Abbas seems less difficult to discern. Rather than facing an outcast and isolated Islamist movement struggling to feed the population over which it exercises control, he may well face a new alliance of wealthy Gulf states, Egypt, Fatah dissidents, and a Hamas movement bent on payback. Abbas did get one calculation correct. There was no discernible protest in the West Bank at the decision to cut electricity payments for Gaza. That should not be mistaken for support for the move, however. 10 years of division and enforced physical separation have rendered Palestinians divided not just politically but emotionally. Gaza is almost like a foreign country. More importantly, though, Palestinians in the West Bank are wary of a PA security apparatus that has become increasingly draconian in quelling dissent. Just this month, the PA shut down 11 websites, all allegedly affiliated to Hamas or Dahlan, even if officials denied a political motivation. Poll after poll after poll after poll find that more than 60% of Palestinians want Abbas to resign, even in the absence of a popular alternative. It's one thing to be less popular than a rival. It's quite another to lose out to no one in particular. What the polls and the resort to authoritarianism both suggest is that Abbas, in his 13th year of a 4-year presidential term, has lost any semblance of popular legitimacy. That was excerpts from an article written by Omar Karmi, a former correspondent for the national newspaper. And now on to our feature presentation, which this morning is an informal conversation with Jeff Halper, Israeli activist and former professor of anthropology at Ben-Gurion University and co-founder of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, an activist group that physically opposes the demolition of Palestinian homes as acts of resistance against the occupation. Jeff is a frequent guest on This Week in Palestine, and this particular conversation takes place in a restaurant where a delegation from the United States were visiting Palestine, Israel, and Jeff is asked to discuss his latest exciting project of trying to develop a constitution and structure for a progressive one-state solution. Recording a conversation with a group in a restaurant is a real challenge, but we hope the sound quality will be sufficient for our purpose. Here is Jeff Halper in conversation.
So what are you up to?
So, you know, it's a little bit what we've talked about, but moved a stage or two ahead. You know, the problem, has always been, for years now, that we don't have an end game. The left, I mean, the progressive forces. The two-state solution is gone. I mean, everybody knows that. Even if they won't admit it, they know it. And so what do we want? I mean, if it's gone, okay. So you can keep protesting forever. I can build another house. I can write another article. I can write another book. I can do this, but what's the point? I mean, you can't be in a political struggle without an end game. If I go into, a member of Congress's office and he or she says, well, what do you want? I don't have an answer. I mean, end the occupation, but that's
sure.
So general. It's
yeah,
not
you
a,
can say platitudes. But
you say platitudes, but that's not a program. I mean, everybody else said Trump will say, I want to end the occupation. Who's not? Who doesn't want to end the occupation?
I want peace.
I want peace. So I've been working very hard to try to get together a good group of Palestinians and Israelis that will begin to formulate what a one-state solution is and and really begin to develop it as a political alternative. So that's what I've been working on.
Well, that's a great idea. How do you go about identifying proper players in that coalition?
Well, right now I don't have a lot of choice.
Oh, okay.
So the people activists, I mean, I know the activist community, and I know professors. For example, one of the people involved is Ilan Papi. He's a very well-known Israeli historian. There's some pretty prominent political and academic and activist people that I have involved. And the idea is to begin to articulate what do we mean by a one-state solution. And we're working with, we want to get together a working group of some lawyers and constitutional lawyers. We want to begin to draft the Constitution.
Oh, yay.
Because the idea is important. It's good that you have to have a concept paper. But when you really want people to understand how it would really work, how would you really create in this area a democracy of equal rights for everybody that nevertheless, protects your right to have your identity, that really gives security to everybody. Instead of talking about it, put together a constitution that really shows you the mechanisms. So that's one thing that's a project we're working on now. And we've got some good people. Richard Falk is involved.
Wow.
And John Dugart, who's a South African human rights lawyer. He used to be at the UN as well. And we're building the team now, kind of.
Does the organization have a name?
No, I mean, I'm doing it under ICAD, under our group. It's not an organization. And I don't know if we want to be an organization. It'd be more of people advocating in different frameworks. And the idea is basically this, that not only did Israel eliminate the two-state solution, but Israel created one state today. There is one state. I mean, it's already exists.
Effectively.
De facto. Effectively. The PA certainly isn't an alternative government. There's one army, there's one borders, there's one currency, there's one electrical system. You know, everything is... So, okay, so let's go with the flow. And we say to Israel, fine, you created one state. Don't blame the Arabs for that. You did that. We accept that. One state. But it has to be a democratic state of equal rights for all its citizens. You can't be one apartheid state.
Well, there's the impasse.
You see. And
that's challenge, put it that way.
That's a challenge, but you know, if you had Israelis and Palestinians advocating for that. Hey, how are you doing? Okay, good. How are you?
We always meet you here.
I know.
Is this your base, like this your office?
They have good food. Remember, they have good
it's
food.
It's my office too. So yeah. Like, that's
where they have good food and beer.
Yeah.
So, the idea is a democracy, I think that, you know, if you had Israelis and Palestinians advocating together for this, it would put everybody, including Americans, in a very awkward position. These two peoples together are asking for what? For democracy. The Americans are going all over the world fighting for freedom and democracy. All right. We'll buy some. We're customers. And, you know, so what would Israel say? What would the U.S. say? What would the people say with that kind of a demand? What are you going to say? No, you can't have democracy. You're going to get apart. I mean, in a way, it just simply, even if you play dumb, just go with that flow, you put Israel in an impossible situation. Becomes, in other words, a national liberation struggle that Israel can characterize as terrorism and all that turns into a civil rights struggle. Well, that's much harder for Israel to...
That gets a little...
You see. Now what do you say?
Are there any politicians, for lack of a better word, on the Israeli and Palestinian side that you think would work on this project? What do you see?
I don't know. Not in the Israeli side right now. But
what do you mean by a politician?
Somebody who's involved in one of the political parties.
So actively.
Merits people.
Yeah, no, they
people.
Would never go there.
Yeah. Would there be academics?
No, there's academics. I mean, there's some good intellectuals right now.
Practically oriented.
Some activists, yeah. We're feeling out now Marwan Barghouti.
Really?
You know, Marwan Barghouti's been in prison for years. He's one of the leaders of Fatah. And he's the only Palestinian that really has the ability to transcend political parties and really be a leader. But we don't know where he is exactly. He's always supported the two-state solution, ironically. So we're through his family and others, we're trying to see if he could be moved to go on to a one-state solution.
Did I not just read that they were, as a result of the successful prisoner strike, they were rewarding him by denying him the right to see his wife for a couple of years? Did I just read that?
Yeah, I don't know, a couple of years, but a couple of months.
2019, I thought I heard it.
I'm not so, I don't know. I can find out.
Is it possible, without disclosing any secrets here, is it possible for people to communicate with Marwan Barghouti? Is there a...
No. You can communicate sometimes through his lawyer.
I see.
You know, that's what we're trying to do. And through his family. I mean, you know, we're in touch with his family. But there's no direct contact.
Give him a cell phone privileges after the strike.
No. Even before the strike.
So,
what about on the Israeli side? Is there an analog on the Israeli side that you would consider?
Well, not yet. I mean, our strategy is kind of a pincher movement. On the one hand, to mobilize the international community. Because the problem is, you've got thousands, hundreds of organizations dealing with Palestine all over the world. It's a huge issue. But they're all stuck because they're not getting leadership from us. They don't know what are we advocating for. BDS, for example, doesn't advocate for a solution in particular. So what are you BDSing for? So that I think that on the one hand, giving that kind of a solution would help galvanize internationals, and on the other hand, then it would create a space for discussion inside Israel. And Palestine, it's a win-win idea. Nobody pays a negative price. Everybody lives wherever they want to live. They have equal rights. You can continue to speak Hebrew. You can speak Arabic.
But isn't that threatening to some people who don't?
It's threatening to the people in power.
In power now, that's right.
And
they're giving up something.
That's right. And that's the asymmetry. Peace for Israelis, peace for Palestinians, if it's connected to justice, means
some higher principle.
Means resolving this. Peace for Israeli Jews means becoming more vulnerable, giving up to your enemies. So it's not a symmetrical kind of a thing. So it'll be a struggle, and
even some advances in publicizing what you do.
Yeah.
Would be very valuable.
I think it would release a dynamic that we don't have today.
Yeah.
I mean, no one has ever really been presented with a real working alternative.
Is there a Palestinian who has the brains and guts to be a real spokesperson for Palestinian who won't be thrown in jail or killed?
Well, Marwan's already in jail,
so
that's an advantage.
I've seen over the last 35 years, everybody who's a potential leader, they're either in jail or they're dead before you know.
Yeah, but you know who would put them in jail first is the Palestinian Authority. They'd be the first one to put them in jail.
I would think
that kind of a leader. Because you got to go against the PA.
Yeah.
And that's going against Israel.
And would you say
it's
the
not
PA
easy.
Is a puppet of America?
No, the PA is a puppet of Israel. And then Israel.
America's a puppet of Israel.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, a lot of truth in that.
Your algebra would tell
you. So just switch the hierarchies.
How do you deal with the whole issue of the, quote, Jewish state?
There wouldn't be a Jewish state. You can't have a Jewish state. I mean, you could have Jewish-Israeli collective rights. In other words, you can continue to talk Hebrew. There'll still be a Hebrew university. You can think of yourself as a Zionist if you want. And that's the cultural Zionism I'm thinking about. But it's not going to be a Jewish state.
Do you think that could be sold to the population?
I think it could be sold, not to everybody. But I think it'd be sold to the majority. The issue is, you see, that's the issue is security, not territory. So if you can convince Israelis that in this, and that's why the Constitution's so important, constitutional guarantees that your individual rights are protected in a democracy, but your collective rights as a people, you can remain the people, are also protected, just like the collective rights of Palestinians are, but within the framework of a democracy. It's very much almost like Canada, where you have the Francophones and the Anglophones, or the UK. Look at the UK, where you have four nations, the English, the Scots, the Welsh, and the Irish, all in one country. You can reconcile. There are multicultural states. Spain, so far.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not that we're the first country to deal with this problem of nationalism versus a state system.
And what happens in Spain may give us something to work with.
Yeah, yeah. It's Spain, yeah. I mean, it could be the other way around.
Yeah.
It could be that we have one state, and at a certain point, then they separate into two states. Because usually you see it the opposite. The idea is two states, and then eventually it'll become one. Well, maybe it'll be like Spain, and there'll be one, and eventually it'll become two. Or not.
I wouldn't hold my breath.
No. But
have you given any thought to addressing what I think is a really important need, and that is what I call land reform?
Of course. Well, that's crucial. But, you know, there's a Palestinian researcher, geographer, named Salman Abu Sita, who's done a lot of research over the years, and he says that 85% of the land that was taken from the Palestinians in 1948 is still available. It's never been built on.
Unused, undeveloped.
Some of it is agricultural land that's used by Israeli kibbutzim and things. Some of it is public parks.
Okay.
Some of it is under forests.
Good.
But it's available. It isn't built on. So that you could have you have to have not just the return of refugees, but you'd really have to create situations with new cities and infrastructure and affirmative actions, you know, where they really are integrated into society. I mean, just to have, and that means land redistribution, it means financial compensations, it means infrastructure. All those things have to be a part of the equation.
And that land that he counted included the land in both the occupied territories as well as...
No, inside Israel.
Inside Israel.
The occupied territories is still almost... I mean, the settlements are only 2.5% of the land.
But as I recall, we went to, I think it was Ocho the other day, and as I recall, beyond the actual settlements that have been settled...
No, of course. You have regional councils.
Regional councils, exactly.
Yeah, but I mean, that would be taken apart.
Yes.
That would be dismantled in a one-state solution.
So in terms of a modus operandi of how this dialogue that academics, intellectuals would have to create this scheme, is there a plan on how you would work together? Are you going to have periodic meetings? Are you going to hire staff?
Yeah, well, we'll see. We're meeting tomorrow in Haifa.
Really?
Right now we're a group of seven people.
Seven people. That includes Pape.
Yeah, Ilan's in the group, yeah. And some other people you probably don't know. But it remains to be seen. I don't know. I wrote the concept paper. I even drafted the Constitution. I did a first draft.
Oh, I would love to see that.
I was a Thomas Jefferson for a day. I mean, I didn't get into all the details about how judges are appointed, but just the...
It's a framework.
A framework, you know, it's a working document. So I have to see...
As was and is our Constitution.
Yeah, that's right. So I'll have to see tomorrow, actually, whether this core group of ours is genuinely together in our thinking. I don't know yet. I mean, it could be that there'll be people say, oh, wait a minute, we don't agree to this, or we don't agree to... I mean, we'll have to see. I don't know.
It's okay if we can
work together.
Yeah, okay.
If we get to...
real impasse, we're here.
I mean, look, what I'm saying, my condition for being involved with this is... We really have to produce something that can work, that can be sold to the Israeli public, the Palestinians, the international. I don't want to come up with a left-wing manifesto that me and Steve and three other people accept. And that's it. I mean, there's no point to that. So it's got to find... And the advantage...
That is so wise.
The advantage of me as an Israeli activist in it is that I can bridge. I know what Israelis... I can anticipate what their
issues are going to be. But I also know Palestinians well enough that I can also kind of anticipate that.
And each will talk to you.
And they'll each talk to me, and we're getting... So I can see if we're going in a place. For example, there is a group called the One Democratic State Group, ODS. But the problem, and they're Israelis and Palestinians, but the problem with them is that they pretty much adopted the Palestinian narrative. So they have a charter that says the name of the country will be the Republic of Palestine.
That's a non-starter.
Well, I'm going to take that out to the Israeli public and say you can live in Palestine. Instead of saying even Palestine Israel, which is what I'm suggesting, Palestine / Israel. I mean, just to
or
say,
the, or the reverse. I mean,
or the reverse, whatever.
As long as,
but it's got to be inclusive.
Yeah.
And the minute you take one narrative and one position, even if it's just, I mean, what they're saying is just, but it's not practical, it's not doable, it's not, you know, as a political, you've got to find that balance between a program that's genuinely just, you're not selling out, but at the same time is inclusive and takes into account, you know, what different people want. So, for example, you see, they say one democratic state, like Kansas. In other words,
it's
no Palestinians,
Kansas,
no Israelis.
Kansas is democratic?
With a small...
Okay.
No, the idea being that they see it, in order to avoid all this problems, they say, let's just have a democratic state of individual voters. We'll all be voters. We'll all vote in this one. I mean, they're ignoring completely the national. I mean, there's, what are you going to pretend that people aren't Palestinian or they're not Israeli or they're not religious Muslims or not religious Jews? I mean, all of those identities don't disappear. You know, we're not just a bunch of voters. You know, we have, and so you've got to take, well, they don't want to deal with that because that complicates things. Okay, so that's unacceptable. You've got to deal with those identities and grievances. On the other hand, you know, I was in favor of a binational state, a state that recognizes that there are two national groups there and builds a democracy based on that. Well, the Palestinians won't have that because for them, binationalism means legitimizing Zionism. The minute we say
Zionism per se.
The minute we say, yes, there's an Israeli national group in this country, we're legitimizing settler colonialism. So we're not going to do it. So what my idea is of this constitutional protection is that you're accomplishing the same thing. You're allowing people to keep their groups and identities within the democracy, but you're not forcing the Palestinians to accept Zionism or to accept this. You know, they can have their narrative and Israelis can have their narrative and it doesn't matter. I mean, today in Mississippi, I suppose, I mean, it's not that the whites have changed. I mean, they're not, you know, but they can have their narratives. I don't care what they say in church. As long as Charlottesville's what happened. You know, as long as it's within a framework. You know, so you've got to
you hear about
build that in.
All the way over here.
We have, first of all, there's TV.
Oh, really? Oh, my God.
And second of all, a lot of it was revolved around Jews.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're stakeholders. And Jews on both sides, too. Because you had right-wing Jews supporting the Nazis, the neo-Nazis. Including Netanyahu's son.
You've got to think of a name that somehow plays to positive reactions by Palestinians and Israelis.
Well, I mean, one name, it's sort of taken. We have to work on them. But, you know, One Democratic State Movement. ODS.
Okay.
That's one.
One Democratic State
So you're meeting in Haifa then tomorrow.
That's tomorrow.
Amazing. Yeah,
maybe. Wow. Oh, that's so exciting.
So we'll see, yeah.
Oh, God bless you and keep going. I don't care who the God is.
What's the outcome that you're hoping for?
I'm hoping that everyone will have read the concept paper. You see, I passed it around.
Is
that
there
I
any
wrote.
Chance we could see that? Or
yeah,
no?
I can send it to you. Sure, okay, nothing
good.
Secret.
Oh yeah, okay.
And
I would love to, personally.
But I'm not sure if they've really read it and really thought it through.
That's the question.
So I got to be sure we're really on the same page.
It's an opener.
So that's one thing I want to. I want to come out of this that we're really on this. Because I'm willing to lead this thing. I mean, there's also some Palestinians that I could work with on that, but you need someone that's going to run with the ball. Elon is busy. He's a professor. He's got 10 things to do. He's not going to... So I'm willing to run with this if I have a mandate. And the mandate has to be from the group saying, yes, we're all on the same page in terms of where we're going. Now let's build this into a movement. Then the idea is we'll constitute a working group of these legal experts to begin to really draft a constitution that is really, meaningful. And
even if you drafted the preamble to the constitution.
Yeah, I have a preamble.
Okay.
Basically what I did...
Can you get agreement on that?
Well, that's what I'll have to see.
I mean, constitution's a big deal. I mean, it has a lot of pieces.
And basically what I did is I took the concept paper in a certain form and I made it like the preamble.
Okay.
So you have the big concept and then break it down into the mechanisms.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's certainly not a legal document. I mean, I'm not a lawyer. But I think it's a good basis. So if this group reads the material and sometimes you're working with academics... It's very difficult.
I've done it all my life.
They're not. Nothing's urgent for them. They treat everything kind of the same. You know, they'll come to a meeting without reading stuff.
Well, they must be politically motivated to some extent.
No, they are
because they're agreed to come.
But there's no urgency there. Even Elon.
There's a hell of a
Elon.
Lot.
Elon.
There's a lot of urgency if you really think about it.
Elon is a very radical Israeli historian. He's written some very influential books. He's really on the front line. So he has a center in the UK, in Exeter. You know, the idea is we're going to have a meeting eventually of people around this document and then to build there. So he's suggesting, let's do it next June. I say, Elon, by next June, who knows what's going to happen here? Let's do it in January.
I would say October 1st.
You know, I would say September 1st. Nothing is urgent for these guys, you know, because they approach it almost like an academic exercise. And they're not...
They will continue to, probably.
Maybe, but I don't care.
Light a fire
but if
more.
They give me the mandate to run with it. In other words, if they force me... to hold off and sit around till next June.
Yeah.
Then I'm not going to do it.
You ain't going to do it.
No, I got other things to do. So if we have an agreement and if I get a mandate, we'll go. We'll do working groups and we'll start putting out materials. We'll start bringing people into the circle more. Because I think there's a lot of people that would sign on to this. And then see how it develops.
Have you, in your concept paper, or in your draft constitution, do you at least contemplate the issue of separation of powers? Did you contemplate...
Not so much. I mean, I didn't get into that detail yet.
Okay.
I mean, would it be better to have a presidential system or a system like this or two houses of parliament? I mean, that detail, I didn't think we're there yet.
One of the other things that I've only recently, really in the last several weeks, become attuned to, and I can't remember who it was that kind of keyed me to think about this, is that the bottom line is that in Israel there's no direct election of any...
No, that's right. No, the Israeli system isn't good.
No, and it struck me that And I've said for a long time that the system is flawed because of the lack of the Constitution and the fact that there is no firm separation of powers. There's
no.
a conceptual separation of powers, but it's not necessarily operative.
No. And the Knesset can overrule the Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court, exactly. And the suppressing, and not only that, but the Knesset can fail to implement Supreme Court decisions and do that with impunity as well. And then, only within the past several weeks, did I become aware of the fact that there's no direct representation, no direct elections of any elected officials. It really places control of the government in the hands of the parties, who in turn are controlled by relatively small numbers
of
voters.
That's right.
And, to some degree, this
not even voters, power brokers.
Power brokers. And to some degree, that duplicates the system we had in the U.S. before we had presidential primaries. You know, when we were youngsters, we didn't have presidential primaries. You know, they're not usual anymore.
Smoke-filled rooms.
Smoke-filled rooms, right. But it struck me that those two concepts...
The art hasn't been perfected much.
Yeah.
But it did strike me that those two concepts...
That's Bernie.
The separation of powers concept and then the whole concept of how do we run our elections... really creates an opportunity that needs to be addressed even before some of the solutions to the problems we have could really be implemented.
And those are the kind of things that the rest of the world will buy into.
That's right. Once you show how it really works, it's a real thing. It isn't just some idea.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, that's,
your deep
that'll come. Yeah.
You know, broader perspective.
So, no, I mean, that'll come fairly soon, that whole structure, once we get the concept agreed upon.
So are all seven people going to be at that meeting?
Tomorrow,
Gosh, I would think by day after, next weekend, you'll have it all put together.
I hope so. I could. I'm primed and ready to go.
I got to get one of those cameras focused on the building and see if there's some white smoke.
I know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, everybody so far said yes, we're on board. But I'm not completely convinced that they've all really...
One-on-one conversations or...
Yeah, one-on-one. We've had a couple little meetings so far.
Okay.
Not of all the seven people.
You have been listening to Israeli activist and former professor of anthropology, Jeff Halper, speaking with a delegation from the United States in Jerusalem. Before we sign off this week, we want you to know about a conference being planned in Cambridge entitled Balfour's Legacy, Confronting the Consequences, which is to be held on November 11th at the First Parish Church in Harvard Square. This conference marks the 100th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration, which committed Britain to the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine without consulting the indigenous population. It will explore the consequences of this British commitment and how we in the United States can push for a resolution of a century-old conflict with equal rights for Israelis and Palestinians. Among many exciting speakers will be Thomas Suarez, whose critical analysis of Zionism in his meticulously documented book, The Terror State, is frequently attacked by all the known suspects and a must-read. The date is November 11th, 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., First Parish Church in Harvard Square. It is free and open to the public. A donation of $10 is requested but not required, and a $5 donation for lunch. And that is all the time we have this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. طفلة تمتطي فوق
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Most radio personalities have a vested interest in maintaining their show on the air and going up the ladder career-wise and making a lot of money. None of those interests prevail here, I can assure you. Our interests are in saving freedom for the world. The only way that freedom can be saved for the world is if we can save the Constitution of the United States of America and save this country. For that is the only document ever created in the history of the world that has ever given any man or woman on the face of this earth freedom, ever. And today, the citizens of the United States of America are the only people in the world who are truly free or who have ever been truly free. But I can assure you, dear listeners, they will not be free for long if they do not wake up immediately. Time is running out. It's about 2 minutes until midnight, and at midnight, the New World Order takes over.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Another day, another war that Trump is trying to start. The Christian Zionists tearing up the Iran nuclear deal for Netanyahu. Yes, Donald Trump wants to break up Obama's peace accord with Iran, and he's pulled out of UNESCO, which is a cultural organisation. Actually, Hollywood pulled out by default decades ago. But he must be itching for a war because he's upping the rhetoric on North Korea too. So we look at Iran and the original 1950s Korean War tonight. And sonic attack on the US embassy in Cuba, or is it just an outrageous lie? Just an excuse to kick Cubans out of Washington. One of the great wonders of this show is every once in a while we fall on a Friday the 13th. This October is a special anniversary. 710 years to the day since the French king, Philip the Fair, ordered dawn arrests of one of the most bloodthirsty cults the world has ever seen. But did the Knights Templar ever really go away, or just change their spots? Oh, and by the way, what has Henry Kissinger been up to recently? We ask whether there are lessons to be learned from historic campaigns in the Middle East, with thousands duped into the previous medieval campaign by the forged letter of Prester John, which said the Saracens had to be defeated to break through to the fictional kingdoms of Christians in India. Also, we look at modern Israel as a crusader state and examine the cult of the assassins. Our sister show Dialects back on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, we go to Hereford and visit one of the country's last independent ironmongers. Dilwyn Jones also has a lot to say about how the city's been managed over the 40 years or so since he opened his shop. Also, California-based Professor Alexander Azadgan fills us in on some history of Kurdistan. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect. Or you can go online at dialectradio.co.uk if you want, and listen now. First, Martin, the idea of tearing up the nuclear deal with Iran seems to be the first thing on Trump's desk today.
Yes, but I think the Americans are the only ones who want to do it. The Europeans, the Russians and the Chinese aren't happy with it. And it's actually a multilateral deal. It's not just a US-Iranian deal. So the possibility is that Trump is going to be isolated on this. Even Britain is not necessarily going to go along with what he wants to do.
What about the Israelis?
Well, the Israelis have nothing to do with it. I mean, they've been pushing for a war with Iran for years now. They've been saying, we want a war with Iran, we want a war with Iran, we want a war with Iran. And of course, in the mainstream in Britain, that's presented as, oh, well, they don't really want a war with Iran. We can still be friends with them. But I think people need to ask themselves the question. They do want a war with Iran. Do we want a war with Iran? Because the Israelis definitely want one, and perhaps we'd better tell the Israelis we're not having one.
Have you got any evidence that the Israelis really do want a war? And why would they want one with Iran?
Well, if you actually look at what Netanyahu has said, he said, we will attack Iran if they don't do X, Y, Z, X, Y, Z. They've been saying it for years. They've been putting it in words of fire 10 feet high. And it's completely unacceptable, in fact. But mainstream opinion in Britain is isolated and insulated from this. Somehow it's all treated, oh, well, it won't really happen. It's all just a bit of an exaggeration. The fact is, the Israelis and the Trumpists want a war with Iran. Do we want a war with Iran? I think the ordinary people in this country have got a pretty clear idea about that. We don't. But well, our allies do.
Trump is due to speak in a few hours. Trump apparently will not sign off the agreement, but I thought it had already been signed off by Obama.
Well, what he has to do, according to, I think it's an internal US thing, is he has to agree every 3 months or so that the Iranians are abiding by the letter of the agreement. And the International Atomic Energy Agency has said, yes, they are, yes, they are, yes, they are. And Trump said, well, it doesn't matter because I'm going to say that they're not because I'm not happy with it.
So what
Netanyahu's not happy.
He's refusing to certify the deal and refer it. Sorry, hang on. What did you just say? Why is he doing just everything Netanyahu wants? What's going on there?
Because his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is very close to Netanyahu. And Trump is a pro-Israeli politician to his fingertips.
So anyway, apparently Donald Trump will refuse to certify the deal and refer it to Congress. So he's not actually able to totally pull out. All he's able to do is to bat it over to Congress. What do you think they're likely to do?
Well, because of the power of the Israeli lobby in the US, they are going to agree with Trump, including the Democrats. So in other words, our closest allies, the United States, want a war with Iran. I don't think Jeremy Corbyn wants a war with Iran. We'll have to find out whether Michael Fallon does. Michael Fallon seems to be in favour of whatever the Americans want. But I think the ordinary people in this country have got to get their voices raised. We don't want a war with Iran. And they've got to recognise that.
Historically, let's just take a step back from the context here. Why are we in a situation where the US seems to be actually in a very powerful role, giving so much money to Israel every year, to come down so hard on one side or the other? Because I don't think there's any specific evidence that either Israel or Iran, is one is more dangerous than the other, is there?
Well, the Israelis are more dangerous than the Iranians. The Israelis are dangerous, but they're our allies. And they're distorting Western policy in extremely destructive ways. They've always been doing it. They're still doing it. And ultimately, we're going to be dragged into a major Middle East war, possibly involving nuclear weapons, because the Israelis have definitely got them, even though the Iranians haven't, simply because we just go along with this stuff when we oughtn't to.
Now, I'm going to ask you a bit of a naughty question now. UNESCO, both Israel and the US, have pulled out of it this week. What does it stand for?
United Nations something cultural organization. So it deals with culture. Things like, deciding whether things are World Heritage Sites, stuff like that.
I'll put you out of your misery. It's the Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization. Now, it does seem again that the US is doing this because the Israelis want them to, but it's also because they simply haven't paid their dues for I think it's 5, 6 or 7 years now. And so they're saying, well, we might as well just leave because you're going to kick us out anyway because we haven't actually paid the money into UNESCO that we're supposed to have.
Well, what you'll find in the United Nations is that there's overwhelming opposition to Israel's policies in the UN General Assembly. So the pro-Israeli politicians in the US, like Trump and others, constantly attack the UN's institutions because the UN's member nations are in general opposed to Israel's policies. And therefore they accuse the UN of being, anti-Israeli, etc. So, that's the bottom line. It's been the bottom line for decades.
Do you think that there's a likelihood of an escalation? And what sort of reaction might there be from Iran?
Well, the Iranians have said pretty clearly, if you do withdraw from this deal, then the deal's off. And we are going to do what we want without paying attention to what you want. Because once the deal's off, it's off. And we can do what we like and you can't tell us.
So he's making this speech now, and I said it's, it was 15 minutes ago or so that Trump's been speaking. He says that Iran is a fanatical regime and is refusing to sign off on the international nuclear deal. One of these days, I suppose, if we were really snazzy, we could cover it live, couldn't we? And maybe even talk over Trump. That would be fun. He said he was referring the deal to Congress and would consult his allies on how to alter the deal. But maybe it won't be altered. Maybe his allies would just tell him, sorry, we're not doing anything.
Well, it causes real problems for the European Union in particular because they're very happy with the deal and they've started to develop commercial relationships with the Iranians and they don't want those jeopardised by Trump's brinkmanship. So, in other words, the one very obvious fallout from this is going to be that the Europeans and the Americans are just not going to agree about this.
Let's move on to talk a bit about... we're going to talk about Kurdistan as well in a minute, but what about Korea? There's been a ramping up of tension over the last few weeks, again, after the UN speech by Trump, where he talked about totally destroying the country. But can we just go back to the 1950s Korean War? What have we got to learn from that? Because it was pretty horrific for the Koreans.
It was, and it's one of those wars that's kind of dipped into the memory hole and everybody's almost forgotten what happened. It was a very destructive war. Millions of people died, and it was sold...
Let's just get the timings, first of all. It was June 1950 to July 1953. And so it was a war between North Korea, with the support of China and the Soviet Union, with South Korea... and the support of the United States. So I suppose, in a way, a kind of typical proxy war where actually the big major superpowers are fighting out somewhere else, not outside their own territories. What's been going on in the Middle East.
To understand the Korean War, you've got to go back to even earlier than that. In 1905, Japan conquered Korea. It was the first country outside Japan that Japan had conquered. And they put in place a brutal colonial regime, which was every bit as bad as the colonial regimes they imposed elsewhere in the Southeast Asia after 1940.
Yeah, I mean, it's fair to say the Japanese are pretty much despised around that part of the world for their colonial attitudes, a bit like the Nazis were.
And there was a resistance to that regime, ultimately led by people who became the Communist Party of Korea, led by Kim Il-sung, pretty much the same as the resistance to French and then Japanese occupation in Vietnam, but much more entrenched because the colonial regime, the Japanese colonial regime had been there since 1905. So there's huge opposition to it. At the end of the Second World War, the victorious powers decided to divide, a bit like dividing Germany, divided Korea into two bits, a bit controlled in the north by the pro-Russian-aligned, pro-Chinese-aligned communists, and in the south, Park Man-ri was imposed, who had been a collaborator with the Japanese. So he was not some democrat, he was a fascist general who'd been aligned with the Japanese. And he started repressing the population. So he killed hundreds of thousands of leftist sympathizers in big massacres. At that point, the North Koreans invaded South Korea to try and stop the fascist dictator imposed by the West from killing the population. And at that point, the West then stepped in to support their fascist dictator puppet against the communists, which then turned into this huge superpower confrontation. The communists did pretty well to begin with. They overran South Korea right down to the final corner, Pusan, I think it is, in the corner of Korea. And then the Western powers intervened, including Britain, and drove the communists all the way back to the Yalu River, which is in the north of North Korea. And they threatened at that point to invade China. Truman, MacArthur, who was the commander, said he wanted to nuke China. Truman relieved him of his command because he didn't want to nuke China. The Chinese army came into the fight, fighting, for example, the Gloucester Regiment at the Battle of the Imjin River. But that was all well inside what is now North Korea. So Britain was invading North Korea at that point when the Chinese army fought them on the Yalu River. And eventually, they all ended up back where they started on the 38th parallel, but with millions of people dead. There was never a peace treaty. There was just an armistice. And one of the things the North Koreans have been pushing for is a full peace treaty. They want a peace treaty that settles it and recognises their regime and allows the possibility, for example, of the mutual developments to take place in the Korean Peninsula. So the idea that this is all the result of Kim Jong-un being a crazy is simply wrong. There's a real running sore here that's been there for decades, always potentially going to turn into something nasty. And eventually it has, and here we are.
I think the bombing campaign of North Korea is one of the most horrific parts of this, because
indeed,
what was happening was a lot of bombs that had been manufactured for World War II were coming up to their sell-by date, and so they were being shipped over and dropped on to North Korea. I mean, an incredible number, in fact, by the Americans. The US dropped a total of 635,000 tons of bombs, including 32,500 tons of napalm, on North Korea, more than during the whole Pacific campaign of World War II.
That's right. So North Korea, a relatively small country, had more bombs dropped on it than the whole of World War II.
No. We're talking about the Pacific campaign in World War II. So ultimately, what has this meant for the region, and what's this meant for the Koreans? Because we've now got one president was deposed, and we've got another president in now, haven't we, and an election beginning of the year.
Yeah, well, South Korea gradually evolved into a more democratic state, although there have been backsliding coups against the democratic process in South Korea. And insofar as there is a democratic process in South Korea, they've been pushing for what they call a sunshine policy, which is, let's not fight the North Koreans, we don't want to fight them, let's try and cooperate with them in various ways. So one of the things they were doing was developing a joint industrial park on the border between the two countries, which was using South Korean technology and managers and North Korean workers, and of course potentially quite a profitable exercise and good for both sides. But that all fell apart when George W. Bush made his Axis of Evil speech and included North Korea in it. And at that point, the North Koreans started to feel paranoid and started to withdraw into their shell and take a more aggressive attitude to the outside world. And many people in South Korea are aware that it is possible to talk to the North Koreans. They used to do it. But the Americans don't really want, I mean, the US don't really want a peaceful solution. They're keeping a militarized situation in Korea is very useful from their geopolitical strategy point of view, because it means that millions of troops are deployed and weapon systems are deployed right near China. Because that's what this is really about, is the competition between China and the US for dominance in the Pacific region. And the Koreans are basically pawns.
What about alleged Japanese assistance in the original Korean War?
Well, the Japanese economy and the British economy boomed during the Korean War, because what happened after World War One was that the economy went down the drain once military industry disappeared. But because the military industry carried on in the because of the Korean War, the Western capitalism actually boomed. And at the same time, of course, the top rate of tax in the US and Britain was about 95%, 98.6%, and that didn't cause the capitalism to fail. It meant that the governments of Britain and the United States have massive resources to reinvest in A, warfare, but B, also welfare. And it just demonstrated the superiority of managed capitalism over planned economies. But of course, everybody forgets all about that.
Now, there's also allegations made in the original Korean War that the US had been carrying out biological weapons, effectively tests, live tests, on North Korean citizens.
Well, they killed millions of North Korean civilians. There was no attempt by the Western powers to distinguish between military and civilian targets.
And what about...
So they just bombed. There was nothing left to bomb at one stage. Curtis LeMay, who nearly got us killed in the Cuban Missile Crisis, he was in charge of the air war in Korea, and he essentially said we had to give up because there was nothing left to bomb. We'd bombed everything to pieces.
Also, what about today with the current situation? Well, I mean, how's it likely to pan out, do you think?
Well, one hopes that there's some rationality on both sides.
And is there any real, do you think, any real preference from the United States? Because I get the impression that they don't really care any more about a South Korean life than they do about a North Korean life.
Well, I mean, Trump saying that he was going to wipe out North Korea, that's pretty scary if you live in South Korea. Even if he was successful in a first strike on North Korea and managed to wipe it out without the North Koreans being able to fire back, that would still leave South Korea pretty radioactive and large parts of southern China. So it's a pretty irresponsible sort of remark by Trump. So that's what we're dealing with. No rational person should make such a threat. He made it. And, of course, a decent prime minister of Britain would have said that's unacceptable. Theresa May had nothing to say.
Yeah, I suppose we should look at some of the most recent allegations. Not allegations, but statements made by both sides. North Korea is threatening Guam again and says its hand is closer to the trigger. On the other side, Trump is threatening North Korea, and ABC News is asking in the US, that's one of the bigger US networks, is the US practicing for war?
Well, I think both sides are now thinking in terms of fighting a nuclear war. The obvious strategy from the point of view of the North Korean general staff, and that's how we have to talk about this, not Kim Jong-un the loony, the North Korean general staff, it's perfectly rational why they want nuclear weapons, because if they didn't have nuclear weapons, it's quite possible they could be nuked by the Americans. The Americans have never said that they won't use nuclear weapons first.
I mean, is there any real
so
point?
The possibility that it might be attacked is always going to be there.
This week, Trump has been, or the US military, and one wonders how much Trump has to do with any of this, has been flying B-1B bombers over South Korea with fighter jet escorts from South Korea. So what's become an increasingly familiar show to force Pyongyang? It came just 2 days after Trump said only one thing will work with North Korea and referred ambiguously to the calm before the storm. When he says only one thing will work, what does he mean?
He means the use of force. But of course, we all know that the North Koreans have got nuclear weapons, and you cannot threaten force against nuclear weapon states without the possibility that they are going to fire their nuclear weapons back. There is a basic asymmetry in the situation. Japan, which used to be the colonial power in Korea, and of course there's still a lot of resentment about that. There was never any reparations paid or anything like that. The Korean economy and the Korean people suffered enormously under Japanese rule. Japan has no nuclear weapons. So it's quite possible that the North Koreans, if they are attacked in a conventional way by Western powers, could nuke. What I would do if I was the North Korean general staff is I would nuke a a Japanese military base. That wouldn't just kill military personnel, but it would also give a, you know, we're fighting a military campaign here. But then that would put the Americans in a strategic dilemma. Do they then attack the North Koreans with nuclear weapons and lose a U.S. city? Yeah, are they prepared to die for the Japanese?
Well, Trump on Tuesday, according to ABC, discussed with military chiefs, including Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, a range of options to respond to any form of North Korean aggression or, if necessary, to prevent North Korea from threatening the US and its allies with nuclear weapons. So they're not just talking about responding, they're also talking about preemptive strikes. If we made a decision to strike a few strategic targets in North Korea, it could happen very quickly, said Rob Gibbons, former U.S. Air Force Brigadier General who served as Deputy Assistant Chief of Staff of Operations for U.S. Forces Korea. He said unless the U.S. decided to undertake a visible military build-up to deter Pyongyang, the public was unlikely to see an attack coming. For now, there's little indication either the U.S. or North Korea is preparing for a resumption of talks.
Well, they're both preparing to fight. And what's really idiotic about Trump is if you were going to carry out a preemptive strike on North Korea, you should just do it, if you were going to do it, without talking about it. Talking about it just means that they know that they're going to be attacked, and under those circumstances, they're going to adopt a posture of response, aren't they? And, of course, this means that everybody's on a hair trigger. All it takes is some fool to mistake an incoming missile for the start of it. It could have just happened by accident.
So what's the easiest way to de-escalate this? Because at the moment, both sides are talking it up, and the Americans particularly are doing exercises right next to North Korea.
Well, I think there is a moderate political position in South Korea, which is why don't we go back to the sunshine policy we had before? And the idea of not talking to the North Koreans is stupid. Tillerson has already said that we are talking to the North Koreans. And he was asked, are you talking directly to the North Koreans? He said, yes, we are.
Finally.
We are talking directly to the North Koreans. So they are talking to each other. Well, if you're going to talk to them, carry on talking to them. Say, well, if we stop doing all of these exercises where we threaten to invade you, will you stop your nuclear program? And that's what both Russia and China are saying. Well, that's the obvious deal. You can't go there every year and have these massive exercises of invading North Korea and expect them to just shrug it off. They're not going to shrug it off. They're terrified they're going to be invaded. You constantly threaten them. You constantly call them names. It's not surprising that they're paranoid and defensive. The obvious way to deal with that is stop threatening them, and then they might be willing to compromise on some of their positions. But with no hope of that at the moment, because Trump is not really a diplomat, is he?
What's the motive behind this, anyway?
Well, the whole motive underlying all of this is to stop China's rise as an alternative
power. And
that's
just why Trump is talking this up and possibly even threatening...
And he's also threatened the Chinese that if they don't close down North Korea by cutting off oil supplies, he will start a trade war with China. And that, of course, means if there's a trade war with China, that will crash the US stock market. So the Chinese are just taking that as a stupid threat. But ultimately, underlying all of this is the US is a fading hegemon. It's dominant in the world at the moment, but it's losing control, especially on the economic front to the Chinese and on the military front to the Russians. And that's a very dangerous situation because they're trying to resolve their problems with economy through threats and bluster.
Former White House strategic advisor Steve Bannon is saying that there is a bit of a problem with all this, that 10 million people in Seoul could die in the first 30 minutes of a conflict from conventional weapons alone.
Yes, but I think that if I was the North Korean general staff, I wouldn't just carry out random attacks on South Korean civilians. In order to win the political war surrounding this, if it comes to shooting, they should go for military targets, but they should hit them hard. So I would imagine, for example, there's lots and lots of ships surrounding Korea, military ships that are from the West. You should drop a nuclear bomb in the middle of that, sink a few aircraft carriers, kill a few hundred thousand.
But it wouldn't necessarily be a nuclear bomb, would it?
Well, it wouldn't have to be, not necessarily. What you might want to do is not go to the nuclear, as long as the other side haven't used nuclear weapons, you carry on fighting but not using nuclear weapons.
I think you've been a bit of a reckless. I'm glad you're not a general in the
North Korean
forces.
This is what people are talking about. If you're going to talk about fighting these battles, people need to talk about the way in which they would be fought. And in actual fact, there is no military solution. Steve Bannon's right. So why is Trump talking about it? It's because Trump's an idiot, which is what Tillerson is reported to have said, is that Trump's a moron. And now Trump's saying that he's not a moron. He wants to take an intelligence test with Tillerson to prove that he's brainier than Tillerson, his own Secretary of State, because Tillerson's reported to have said that Trump was a moron because he went to this PowerPoint presentation and carried on talking through his backside, even though the generals don't believe in fighting a war that they can't win.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Funnily enough, we didn't hear that on the BBC, did we? Anyway, so we're going to have a look at Kurdistan now. And earlier this week, last week, I spoke to a chap called Professor Alexander Azadgan. He's from Saddleback College in California, but he's born in Iran. So he gives a very interesting, I think, perspective here for a few minutes on the history of Kurdistan, because they've just had a referendum there, and there's already some problems with Iran. I mean, because they've decided they want to separate from Iran, a little bit like Catalonia wants to separate from Spain.
The Iranians believe the Kurds are actually the most Iranian of all the clans. And by Iranian, I'm talking about the ancient identity of Aryan. Whereas in other countries such as Iraq, Turkey, and even Syria, they're very much looked upon as foreigners or people with heritage from long places, from places long away.
Okay, so you're talking about Aryans. Now, this is what Hitler was talking about, the Aryan master race. I don't imagine you're talking about Aryans as a master race, but I think this will be news for a lot of people that there may be Aryans in Iran or in Kurdistan.
The word Iran literally means land of the Aryans. It's a different phonetic pronunciation of what we consider very sacred. The Iranian and also Indian version of Aryanism is very different than the perverted version of the Third Reich, who misidentified Nordic people as Aryans. There's nothing truthful about that. Aryans, light, which the Nazis misinterpreted as physical light, you know, lightness of skin, again, was a fallacy. When we talk about the Aryan light, we are talking about the light within, which refers to clairvoyance, hypersensitivity, and all sorts of esoteric abilities that these people have. And there's another story or another interpretation of this is that the Aryans itself is another phonetic pronunciation of Atlantean. So this goes back to prehistory for those who believe in Atlantis, and Plato, of course, talked about Atlantis heavily.
Is there any evidence for Atlantis? I mean, some people say it was like the island of the Azores or something like that.
It's the evidence is extremely circumstantial. It's obviously not empirical, otherwise it would be in our textbooks. Plato talked about it heavily. It wasn't just a place. We believe it was an entire continent. It wasn't just some island with circular buildings or structures around it.
We could look back on it now and say, well, maybe the Phoenicians or someone had already discovered the American continent.
Absolutely. There are many, 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 many interpretations of that. And of course, it wasn't the Italians. I know the Italian-American community likes to take pride that Amerigo de Vespucci or even Columbus discovered this area. It wasn't. Even if you go to very near history, it was actually the Vikings who got here from Greenland, from Iceland, Denmark, Norway, and then Greenland, and they came down to Nova Scotia and that area. But that's besides the fact. Nevertheless, it is a very huge discussion and part of this Aryan identity. Like I said, Iran for the past 2,600 years not only makes sure that the Kurds were their identity, their separate identity as an Aryan tribe was respected. If you go to Persepolis, the ruins of Persepolis in South Iran, where Cyrus, Darius, Xerxes, and all these great kings build incredible structures, in their stone graving, they always distinguish between the Persians in their dress form and what they call Medians, who are the ancient ancestors of what we call the Kurds today. And that came into existence calling it the Medo-Persian Empire that Cyrus created. The areas that they call Kurdistan was a huge continent that the Medes controlled. However, when they came into union with Cyrus around 2,500 years ago, Cyrus the Great, formed this incredible alliance. It was called the Medo-Persian Empire in the beginning. And then as time went by, the word Mede was dropped and we just had the Persian Empire.
So it's a bit of tangent we went on there, looking at America possibly being a kind of legendary Atlantis. But Martin, there is obviously connections between the Kurds and the Iranians for a long, long time.
Well, the languages are related, and they're all Indo-Europeans, basically. That's another phrase for the Aryans. So they're all related languages.
But when it comes to Kurdistan and this recent referendum, a lot of people are looking at it and saying, well, at last, maybe the Kurds are going to get their homeland. But it does seem as if this is being used as a tool to actually create a kind of free Kurdish state, which isn't necessarily in the same place as the Kurds necessarily traditionally live. I mean, for example, they're talking about giving some of the land in Syria and Iraq to the Kurds, but not part of Turkey.
Well, it's the Kurds were not given a state during the stitch-up at the end of the First World War. After the Ottoman Empire. They never had an independent... Obviously, there were all sorts of dirty deals done at that stage, and the Kurds were not recognised as a... You know, the imperialist powers, particularly the French and the British, didn't want an independent Kurdistan because and the British in particular wanted to control the oil fields in the north of Iraq, and therefore Iraq was extended into what is now the Iraqi Kurdistan to make sure that those oil fields remained inside Iraq so that Britain would have access to those oil fields. So good old Britain created the problems that we're now attempting to resolve today.
What about Kirkuk? Because there seems to be a little bit of a dispute over that. The Iraqi capital, Baghdad, aren't really very happy that it looks like Kirkuk might suddenly become a new country run by the Kurds.
Well, no, Kirkuk is going to be was included in the referendum, even though it's got what used to be an Arab majority, but a lot of people have gone, so they've moved Kurds in there. And, of course, both sides want it because it's got oil fields.
I mean, is this just the old divide and rule? Let's give them a nice kind of duel in the middle, Kirkuk, and let them fight over it and watch
them
fighting?
I mean, what's going on is the same things that's been going on in the Middle East ever since the end of the First World War, which is that the real needs and interests of the local population are being overruled and messed around by the powers, outside powers, who've got their own interests. And... that's what's happened in this case. Nobody, apart from the Israelis, have recognised the independence of this Kurdish mini-state because it causes too many problems in other states and setting precedents in completely different parts of the world, like Kashmir, for example, in India. So although one might, in theory, be in favour of people having referendums to declare independence, the question is always going to be, well, who's going to be allowed to vote in the referendum, where's the borders going to be, all of this stuff. And it's always disputed.
What about this Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters map from the US Army magazine? It's the Armed Forces Journal, I think it was, in 2006. Actually shows Free Kurdistan as a new country in the Middle East, and there are lots of other new countries. I'll put a link up. I'll put a copy of that map up on our show page, because it does start to look as if this referendum has been used just to create this new state, to rob a bit of Syria, to rob a bit of Iraq, and not Turkey, which is one of the main areas the Kurds are from.
Well, indeed, and that map was actually criticised by Turkish officers when it was used in a NATO training session, because they, of course, are not very happy about the idea of being a free Kurdistan or any kind of Kurdistan anywhere.
There's also other countries like Free Baluchistan. There's the Islamic Sacred State. So that's once Saudi Arabia's broken up, a new state around Mecca. The Arab Shia state around Basra, which is roughly around present day Kuwait. The Greater Jordan gets a much bigger area. Syria has shrunk a lot in this new map, and then they have Sunni Iraq and Free Kurdistan. So Iraq is much, much smaller than it was.
Yeah, well, in other words, after the stitch-up at the end of the First World War, the Americans now want to come in, the US wants to come in and have another stitch-up with Israeli support. The Israelis, of course, are very much with the Yinon plan in the 1980s, was to balkanise the local states and get them all fighting each other.
Is it as simple as this is really a US version of what the British did and the French did with the Sykes-Picot?
In a word, yes. But of course, what they're doing is they want to remake the Middle East, and they want to change the borders to suit a new power configuration. But the interests of the locals are still being overruled, and the Kurds would be very unwise to form alliances with the Israelis and the Americans. They can if they wish, but everybody else is going to have it in for them if they do. And they've got to live with their neighbours in Baghdad and elsewhere, and they may need to think about that. They're landlocked. Yeah, if they want to export oil from Kurdistan, it's going to have to go over somebody else's territory. And if you get really on bad terms with them, then it's not going to happen, is it?
On the positive side, US lawmakers want to force the US military out of the Yemen war. US Air Force's refueling operations for the Saudi-led coalition striking Yemen could end if lawmakers succeed in passing a House bill. Representative Ro Khanna, California Democrat, member of the House Armed Services Committee, introduced House Congressional Resolution 81, which had ordered the US military removed from unauthorized hostilities in Yemen.
Well, that's a minority of Congress people who have put that forward. The usual suspects of reasonably decent US Congress people. The majority are backing the government's position of supporting Saudi Arabia and the genocide, really, which they're carrying out in Yemen.
Also this week, British jihadi White Widow has been killed by a US drone, reports The Sun. Amazing that the Americans and the British military go straight to The Sun rather than anyone else. Maybe they're just trying to help The Sun with their flagging circulation. But Sally Jones, a British jihadi who's recruited online apparently for the Islamic State group, has been killed in Syria by a US drone along with her 12-year-old son, The Sun reported. A couple of things about this, Martin. Is it okay for, say, American or British to kill British people abroad without actually putting them on trial or anything like that? And also, we've only heard about this something like 2 months after it's happened.
Well, there are legal questions about whether you're allowed to just go around zapping people, whether, you know, on the basis of there's no trial, there's nothing like that. The second point is, if I can just make the point, is I don't necessarily believe that this happened. I don't necessarily believe this person exists, or that they're already dead, or that they killed them, because they just make stuff up.
Michael Fallon, Defence Secretary, has been saying you run the risk every hour, every day, of being on the wrong side of an RAF or US missile.
Well, you certainly do if you weren't part of the Syrian army at Deir ez-Zor a few months ago, where the RAF zone was part of killing over 80 Syrian army soldiers who had been defending the city against the ISIS. And, of course, both the Syrian military and the Russian military say that the RAF are actually flying close support for ISIS.
In this Reuters report, one Western security source speaking on condition of anonymity said that Jones had not been heard of since earlier this year. So the assumption was that she may be dead, although the source refused to confirm the details of the Sun report.
Well, in other words, we're being given war propaganda about the killing of, it's all sensationalised. She used to be a punk rocker, and now she's been killed, and she's a white widow, and all the rest. I just don't believe it. Lots of people are being killed all the time. I don't believe that they're telling us the truth about who's being killed or on what basis.
Reuters stress here that other IS militants have been reported dead only to reappear, and a CIA spokesperson refused to comment.
Well, indeed, and of course, as I've just said, both the Syrian military, the Russian military, the Iranian military and the Iraqi military based in Baghdad believe that the RAF and other Western powers are actually supporting ISIS. They've been dropping them weapons, they've been recruiting them. And as you well know, there was a Canadian intelligence agent who was arrested in Turkey trying to entrap British girls to join ISIS. And that was definitely on the record. So the view in the Middle East in general is that ISIS is a puppet of the Saudis and the Americans and the British and the Israelis. That's the view.
These are the first signs of sonic attack. You will notice small objects such as ornaments oscillated. You will notice vibrations in your diaphragm. You will hear a distant hissing in your ears. You will feel dizzy. You will feel the need to vomit. There will be bleeding from orifices.
Now that's Hawkwind Martin from the 1970s talking with one of their songs from the Space Ritual album called Sonic Attack. But this is what we're being told to believe that's been going on in the US Embassy in Havana.
Well, yes, and on that basis, they've withdrawn their personnel from the US Embassy in Havana and then expelled Cuban diplomats from New York. In other words, Cuban-American relations, which were starting to thaw under Obama, are now back in the deep freeze. Now, but I can't see that the Cubans have got any interest in that. And therefore, the obvious question to ask was, who does have an interest in this? And that would be the sort of military-industrial complex in the US, wouldn't
it? It does seem to go alongside the expulsion of the Russian diplomats, kind of above board. They've just said, well, we're expelling you. With this one, though, it looks like it'd be difficult for them to come up with an excuse to get rid of these people, except this is the perfect excuse. So do you think this is real, this sonic attack?
Well, it's hard to say. They may just be making it all up, but it's obviously quite possible for the Americans to carry out a sonic attack on their own people and blame it on the Cubans, which, of course, was what they were going to do with Operation Northwoods in 1963. They were going to carry out bomb attacks and aircraft hijackings inside the US and kill lots of people and blame it on the Cubans.
Well, The Guardian is saying this week mass hysteria may explain sonic attacks. The top neurologists say, despite 22 Americans reporting symptoms, no evidence of a weapon or recordings have been found. They say a psychosomatic disorder could be linked to the high stress in Havana.
Yes, it could just be made up as well. The diplomats have all been told to say that they're feeling ill so that they can be withdrawn. Or, if you're that cynical, they could carry out a sonic attack on their own diplomats and then say, hey, the Cubans are doing this. Perfectly feasible.
Is it also feasible that the Americans are doing this in various parts of the world and therefore they accuse others of doing it to them? Because we're getting into the situation now quite often where they're actually doing the stuff they're accusing others of.
Yes, and not only that, they're actually quite capable of doing it to their own personnel in order to achieve a political effect. As I mentioned earlier, Operation Northwoods, they were quite prepared to kill US civilians in order to blacken the name of the Cubans. And it was signed off by all the top military, including Curtis LeMay, who we were mentioning in relation to the Korean War earlier. And they were quite happy to kill US civilians in order to blacken the name of the Cubans. And it was all signed off by the top military brass.
Okay. Overall, though, do you think this? What's the value of keeping for Cuba and for the rest of the world of keeping good relations with the US? It's very close by, isn't it? And there's a load of history to this.
Well, indeed. And, at the end of the day, good relations in the world are in everybody's interests, but not if you're a warmongering state like the current US. It looks to me as if they're upping the ante with every opponent that they have on the planet. They're not even picking on one at once. They're going for broke by having war talk about all of them.
I'll ask you the same as I did about Iran and North Korea. What's the motive here? I just find it difficult to see. Why would you want to just have a complete breakdown in relations and kick out the diplomats?
All right, well, let's think of it this way. The military-industrial complex makes its money by producing weapons. We were talking about, the job losses in Lancashire earlier, and therefore they need enemies, otherwise there's no point having any weapons. So that's a basic reason why they do it. And the other reason, as I said earlier, is that they are losing their hegemony in economic terms. The Chinese economy is now slightly bigger than the US economy. Now, of course, per head, they're much poorer. But that means that all history books show that the big powers are the ones with the biggest economies. Now, the US is losing its relative position as the dominant power, as it has been since World War II. And the only way for them to stop that, other than by cooperating and trying to share, is to actually try and mess up their opponents, which is what they're trying to do.
Okay, let's have a look at the issue, the Friday the 13th issue, which is this modern crusade. Is it fair to call what's happened with the British plan, the Balfour Declaration, the Six-Day War, which was the stealing of all of the occupied territories, and now we are in the situation where there are all sorts of pushes towards this Christian Zionist plan. This seems to me to explain a lot of the reasons behind an ideological, a fundamentalist ideological motive behind the US's absolutely amazing, unswerving support for Israel and for the Israeli government.
Well, I think there is there's certainly ideological alignment going back to the First World War, and politicians like Lloyd George here in Britain having been brought up on Bible stories, feeling that they wanted to give the Jews a home in Palestine, even though most Jews didn't live in Palestine and had nothing to do with Palestine. And that certainly caused a lot of problems over the years. But you've also got the general geopolitical tensions I was describing earlier, and the Israelis are part of, you know, those kind of general
back
tensions.
Here in Britain, we've seen apparently a big rise in anti-Semitism, particularly in the Labour Party. But some commentators, including the Jewish musician Gilad Atzmon, he says that the cure for British anti-Semitism may be within reach. To fight anti-Semitism, deprive groups like the CST, which is a lobby, a Zionist lobby in Britain, and similar organisations, stop giving them taxpayers' money. Anti-Semitism, he says, is not really a social phenomenon. It's instead a multi-million pound industry. The more we spend on the fight against it, the more incidents are recorded to justify further spending. Now, this does seem like almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you set up organisations and give them British government funding to look into anti-Semitism, they're going to find it. It's a bit like MI5 looking into Islamic terrorism. The more money you give them to do it, the more they're going to find.
Well, I think there's definitely a grain of truth in that. But underlying all of this is the main political... It's about the state of Israel. So definition of anti-Semitism, which is now current, used by the British government, means opposition to the existence of the state of Israel is classified as anti-Semitic. Now, I would argue that that's simply wrong. Simply wrong. It's a political position. There's lots of different political positions, for example, on recognition of Catalonia, of Kashmir, of Ireland, or whatever. And being opposed to the existence of the state of Israel is a political position.
Are you
position.
Saying then that Jerusalem doesn't belong to the Jews?
It doesn't under the 1948 agreement recognising the state of Israel. Jerusalem was very definitely not to be part of Israel. Not. And they won't accept that, but that's what was agreed. And in fact, because they won't stick to what was agreed, that puts them in the ballpark where you can say, well, we're not going to recognise you as an independent state. You can carry on being what you are for as long as you can get away with it, but you don't necessarily have a seat at the United Nations. You're going to lose it.
It's not been republished by InterVarsity Press. It's called Christian Zionism, The Roadmap to Armageddon. It's looking like the biggest self-fulfilling prophecy ever in the history of humanity. It's ISBN 0830 853 685. But the programme here, Martin, is six steps. The Jews, number one, will remain God's chosen people, absolutely unswervingly. Final restoration of Jews to what they call the scriptural lands. Then three, Palestine belongs exclusively to the Jews, including Gaza. Four, Jerusalem must be restored as Israel's final capital, exclusively for Jews. Five, the third temple will be built and consecrated. Priests and sacrifices will resume. And finally, there will be an apocalyptic war with Islam breaking out with no prospect for peace. Now, it does seem as if there are people, I mean, we heard those reports from Jerusalem last week, that actually do believe that war is inevitable. That is a really serious kind of fundamentalist belief that surely is going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy if they carry on believing it.
Yeah, I mean, what you mentioned there is the Christian Zionist beliefs, isn't it? And you've got similarly extreme views on the right wing in Israel. And as I've sent you earlier, the Israelis want us, the British, to have a war with Iran. That's on the agenda. Do we want to go to war with Iran to keep the Israelis happy? I suspect that that's not many votes in that in Britain.
Also, Martin, it's the time of year where you get a little bit down, don't you, often this time of year?
Well, yes, and for various reasons, yep.
Why?
Well, I'll talk about it off-air, if that's okay,
no,
Tony.
No, I'm going to say something about it, because okay. It's just because the days are closing in, and it gets a little bit more gloomy, doesn't it? And
that's one of the reasons.
Also, but there is hope on the horizon. Magic mushrooms may one day treat depression. Study investigating active substance in the illegal drug is due to launch early next year. Psilocybin will be studied in patients who fail to respond to existing therapies. Now, I hope you don't need to be part of these trials, Martin, but there is some serious people are seriously looking at these psilocybin mushrooms as actually being able to help people get out of depression.
Well, it doesn't surprise me in the slightest. But the drug laws in this country and elsewhere are irrational to the point of extremism. And, you know, there's a huge issue there. The banking system is dependent upon illegal drug money, but at the same time, we can't talk about it.
Well, magic mushrooms, apparently, according to the Daily Record in Scotland, were found growing in the Queen's Garden at Buckingham Palace by TV gardener Alan Titchmarsh.
Well, they grow all over the place in Britain, and no doubt our ancestors are very well aware of them, and they may well have taken them. I mean, archaeologists are quite clear that it's quite likely they were used by our ancestors in prehistoric times, because there were no laws against it.
It is the general mushroom season of the year, when all the mushrooms generally start to pop up around woodlands. I did a tweet with eight different sorts that I saw last week. But anyway, two major things about mushroom picking. Make sure you identify fungi 100%. 99% identification is no good. And also, don't just pull them up. Cut the stem with a fingernail or penknife and leave the stem base in the soil, please. That's the mycelium can carry on growing then. So just a few things about magic mushrooms. Funnily enough, the Daily Telegraph has done the best summary of the real ones, because the problem with the Daily Record is they were calling the fly agaric mushrooms the magic mushrooms, which, of course, they're not. They're a different type of mushroom. So actually getting the identification right isn't always helped by these press reports. But the Telegraph is pretty good. It's saying there are roughly 200 species of mushroom that can be classified as magic. Also, they say in only two European countries is the possession and cultivation of magic mushrooms fully legal. Would you like to guess which ones they are?
Well, in Britain, I understand the law is as long as you haven't processed them, they remain legal. But once you process them, then they become illegal.
It's in the Czech Republic and in Spain. Also, they're not addictive in any chemical sense of the word, although users can become psychologically dependent. And as might be expected, tripping on magic mushrooms is not a recent phenomenon for thousands of years. You mentioned that. They've been widely used in religious ceremonies in here in Britain, Martin, maybe before the Romans, for example?
Well, modern archaeologists are fairly clear that our prehistoric ancestors did use things such as magic mushrooms as part of their religious rituals, which is still very common, of course, in Latin America amongst indigenous peoples today.
Anyway, I'll put our forager's guide, which is excellent, from the it's called Edible Mushrooms by Jeff Dan, a forager's guide to the wild fungi of Britain and Europe. I'll put that up on our show page, and also the wild mushroom. I was quite surprised that the Daily Telegraph actually had the best information about all this. Anyway, time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up live on Facebook, it's Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Labour Councillor for Central Ward, Kai Dudd. Also, thanks, you just heard them, old Labour Oxford economist, Martin Summers. This short show's story links and comment page is thisweek.org.uk.
Project Censored Show, I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we spend the hour discussing the media fighting fake news. We're joined by Dr. Rob Williams of the Action Coalition of Media Education to discuss critical media literacy in an age of digital disorientation. We'll also speak with journalist Abby Martin, host of the Empire Files on Telesur and Media Roots about media propaganda. We'll hear dispatches from her recent trip to Venezuela. We'll also hear from Project Censored's Associate Director, Dr. Andy Lee Roth, about our newest book, Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World, just out on Seven Stories Press. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we spend the hour doing what we oft do here at the Project Censored Show, looking at the media. Today, we're going to be talking about fighting fake news in an age of digital disorientation. We're joined first by Dr. Rob Williams. He's a professor at the University of Vermont, founding president of the Action Coalition for Media Education. He is the author of the recent book, Most Likely to Secede, What the Vermont Independence Movement Can Teach Us About Reclaiming Community and Creating a Human-Scale Vision for the 21st Century. He's also co-editor with Julie Frechette of Media Education for a Digital Generation. Additionally, Rob Williams is a contributor to Project Censored and also on the board of our collective efforts at the Global Critical Media Literacy Project. You can learn more at gcml.org. Rob Williams, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
So good to be with you and Peter, Mickey.
It's fantastic to have you on, as always, Rob. And as usual, our planets align. We talk about off-air about some things that you've been working on that directly correlate to what Andy Lee Roth and I have been working on in the next Project Censored book, Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World. And you've been working on an article called Fighting Fake News in an Age of Digital Disorientation, Towards Real News, Critical Media Literacy Education, and Independent Journalism for the 21st Century Citizens. And again, couldn't have more of a crossover with what we're all doing here. So, Rob, let's just kick it off and talk about, you know, where are you going with this piece, and how does this dovetail with your work of late?
Really, the goal is to marry critical media literacy education, which we've been doing for a long time at ACME, with independent journalism, which, of course, dovetails beautifully with the work that Project Censored and GCMLP have been doing for a long time, particularly Project Censored. And we've been reviving Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman's five-filter propaganda model of news, which I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with, really charted in their book Manufacturing Consent back in the, I think it was 1987 when the book first came out. 1988. And in that book, of course, in the propaganda model of news, Chomsky and Herman posited a five-filter model through which all news and information has to pass in the U.S. so-called news and information culture before it saw the light of day, before it made its way to readers and viewers and what have you. And what's so fascinating now, of course, living in the digital age, or the age of digital disorientation, is the challenge of sort of updating that filter-driven propaganda model of news for the digital age. And what I proposed in this book chapter that we're working on right now, and in some of the work we're doing at Vermont Independent and here at the University of Vermont in Burlington, is updating this filter model. And we've added five filters for the digital age.
Let's talk about that in a moment. You start, of course, you know, George Seldes' great quote, journalism's job is not impartial, balanced reporting. Journalism's job is to tell the people what's really going on. Yeah. And when you're talking about adding to the list in our upcoming book here, Censored 2018, Edward Herman contributed a chapter on the propaganda model. And so, again, great dovetailing and symbiotic work going on here. And before we get into the additional filters and things that you're talking about, what do you mean by age of digital disorientation?
It's probably best captured in something a bewildered reporter said early in the year, right after Inauguration Day, in response to yet another sort of tweet storm from Donald Trump. He said, "What does Donald Trump mean when he uses words? What does Donald Trump mean when he says words?" And I just thought that was like the funniest and most telling sort of journalistic moment of the year so far.
Not only post-truth president, but postmodern.
Like, we're so far down kind of the postmodern rabbit hole in the, as encapsulated by this one sentence, that words themselves have lost all sort of ability to anchor us in a shared reality. And there's a big argument, I think, to be made that that's exactly how sort of creeping fascism, totalitarianism work. It's about unmooring people and putting them off balance, about disorienting people, regardless of their party or their politics or what have you, keeping people in sort of a perpetual state of disorientation. I think that's what we're witnessing right now. And everyone here in Vermont is really kind of scratching their head going, what? What is going on? Where are our anchors to a common reality?
It's as if we're in the eye of the Twitter storm. It's like scandal fatigue. Every time one turns around, I mean, and it's as if the media has been dragged and sucked into the morass that they helped create in the first place.
That's exactly right. And I think we're all in agreement that Trump is a symptom of a much larger, deeper, and older historical problem, which is this problem of how power is exercised in a heavily mediated age by corporations and governments who use these kinds of disorienting propagandistic moves to keep everybody off balance and keep everybody from organizing.
Well, indeed, in an era of fake news, alternative facts, post-truth, I mean, again, this has sort of been the riff and the theme that we've been dealing with here all year on several talks. We'll get into that here momentarily. Peter?
It seems that we're reaching this era, and certainly digital media contributes to that, where people are so used to simply entertainment, all news becomes hyper-real, and that people just don't know what to believe anymore, and almost, in fact, can't have a reality because of the contradictions. You know, I mean, during the campaign, it was Hillary's progressive, which is a huge contradiction. Or we have to go to war with Russia, or Venezuela's a dictatorship. All of these are lies. You know, or North Korea is ready to destroy San Francisco. These are lies, but because there's so much of this propaganda inside of corporate media and digital media today, you don't know what's real anymore.
I think that's right, Peter, and I think it's really the perfect marriage of the Huxleyan warning that we are amusing ourselves to death, as Neil Postman famously said, a kind of the marriage of the Huxleyan warning with the Orwellian warning, which is the power of Big Brother with a capital B and a capital B in the form of state-driven or deep state-driven propaganda to completely disorient people. And I think that's what we're seeing right now. It's not an either-or phenomenon. It's a both-and, a Huxley and Orwell combined kind of crazy disorienting phenomenon.
Indeed, and it keeps coming up over and over again. And, you know, going back to such classic works like you mentioned, whether it's Huxley, Orwell, Postman, or in between even Orwell in terms of the politics of the English language, extraordinary reliance on euphemisms. And now it's in terms of that reality, we know about euphemisms and George Carlin's rants on that. But now we've gone even further, jumped the shark to alternative facts. It's beyond confirmation bias. Confirmation bias is where we go out and look for something that's factual that supports our view only. But now we live in a culture where from the top down, it's being modeled that you can manufacture material or evidence, or my ignorance is just as good as your knowledge and facts. That is extraordinarily destructive to any democratic culture. And you and I also agree, I'm sure, on this point, because this is one of our mainstays, certainly through the Global Critical Media Literacy Project, through ACME, Project Censored. And that's the importance of critical media literacy education is the antidote to the onslaught of fake news and alternative facts in a post-truth world.
That's exactly right, Mickey.
So talk to us about that. Rob Williams, University of Vermont. Talk to us about more of the critical media literacy education component, particularly as you're outlining in your chapter with your additional filters.
We're really in the business, I think, of providing citizens with kind of three broad arenas, if you will. One is greater knowledge, and I think historical knowledge is deeply lacking. I would start there. Second would be skills, the kinds of skills of access, of media analysis, of media evaluation, of media criticism, of media production in the digital age to really combat this digital disorientation. And then thirdly would be an activist sensibility, or if the term activist is too radical for some, a sense of civic engagement that we want citizens to be involved in projects larger than themselves designed to make their world's a better place for more people and the planet. So it's really about knowledge, number one, skills, number two, and activism, number three. And everything that we do, I think, in critical media literacy circles drives towards those three overlapping goals. The other thing to say about critical media literacy education is that we're fiercely independent when it comes to our funding and the networks that we build. A lot of media education in the United States and globally is, shall we say, massaged by corporations, governments, yeah, who have, of course, their own agendas.
Back to the propaganda model.
Well, that's right. We're trying to carve out an independent space separate from government, separate from corporations, where we can cultivate this sensibility, this critical media literacy sensibility with people of all ages, not just students and universities, colleges, K through 12 schools, but also, I think, thinking adults who are as bewildered and disoriented by a lot of this stuff as our young people are.
Rob, you used the word global, and I'd like to pick up on that, because we really are talking about global media today. And I'm referring to Lee Art's book, The Global Entertainment Media, where he looks at MSNBC and CBS and ABC and those. They're all transnational. Disney is 150 countries. This is a global media project now. In many cases, it's coming from transnational capital. That is, it's not just the U.S. anymore. It is a global capitalist project to protect capitalism and to protect the privacy of corporations and the military in their adventures to allow capital flow anywhere in the world. That's the entertainment model of where we are today. So all of this power concentrated in less than, you know, 0.001% of the world's population, the multi-billionaires and millionaires. And that's what corporate media is today. It's owned and run by these mega wealthy people using those filters to control us and get us to behave and to consume and to believe in the rightfulness of capitalism to be anywhere in the world. It's totally a controlling, entertaining media.
That's right, Peter. And you've done some pioneering work on the transnational capitalist class. And I think part of our job in the critical media literacy education arena, a big part of it is to connect the dots between what you just talked about with the transnational capitalist class and the way in which that particular group of people, that network of people, massage our so-called news, information, and entertainment digital media platforms for maximum messaging benefit to them. I think that's absolutely right.
I'd like to remind listeners, you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking with Dr. Rob Williams, University of Vermont, on the board at the Action Coalition for Media Education, as well as the Global Critical Media Literacy Project. Rob is co-editor most recently of a book called Media Education for a Digital Generation, co-edited with another friend of ours, Julie Frechette. And Rob, let's go into defining some of these other terms that you're getting at in the piece that you're working on, In an Age of Digital Disorientation. Before we get into fake news, let's define real news.
There's a big conversation about what constitutes real news. But for me, real news has six key simple characteristics. Number one, it's recent. Number two, it's relevant, by which we mean to say it's much talked about in the culture. Number three, it's reliable, which means you can tap into the sources from which that story comes from and recognize their authenticity and their accuracy. Number four, real news is about foregrounding power relations, what some call hegemony or hegemonic relations. Real news also, I think, has multiple points of view. And finally, real news is about historicizing the story. So much of what we get, what passes for news, quote unquote, in our culture right now is completely devoid of any sort of historical or hegemonic context. What the great writer, he worked out your way in California, Wallace Stegner, for many decades, called the amputated present. So much of our news is kind of trapped in the amputated present. It has no connection to the past. It has no connection really to the future. It kind of washes over us, and then, you know, we're on to the next story. So those are the six ingredients that, in our mind, comprise realness.
Well, Rob Williams, fellow history professor here as well, I teach a whole critical reasoning course that looks at the intersection of past and present as a roadmap for the future and looks at the propaganda of historical construction, which deals directly with looking at propaganda model and filters and these very definitions that we're getting at. So now let's talk about the phenomenon of fake news. There's many definitions. You know, a decade ago, fake news was a satire like Stephen Colbert. But fake news is literally manufactured false information and propaganda is very old. And the current iteration of fake news is it's been weaponized to allow people to dismiss things with which they disagree. Talk to us a little bit about how you see fake news.
The term fake news is used in a bunch of different ways. One is to dismiss any argument or counter-argument that you or your party or your group of people or your stakeholders simply don't agree with. Fake news can also be used to demonize an entire network or channel or platform, which I think is incredibly dangerous, actually. And when I talk with my students about this phenomenon, I said, look, some of you grow up in a culture where you think everything on Fox News is complete and utter Others of you grow up in a news culture where you think everything on MSNBC or Democracy Now or left-leaning news channel is complete But really, you have to take news stories, so-called news stories, one at a time and really unpack them and look at the definition of real news.
Each story, each time, right?
That's right. I mean, if you're a so-called left-leaning politically, you know, even Fox News is going to run a story that's going to be of interest and maybe accurate. For example, when they interviewed Julian Assange last election cycle in the fall from the Ecuadorian embassy outside of London, in which he gave sort of an extensive interview in which he talked about his own motivations and WikiLeaks motivations for releasing the 5,000 Podesta emails, et cetera. That was kind of a scoop for Fox, actually. It was kind of interesting. And no other national news source in the U.S. anyway was willing to touch that. And, you know, of course, Fox was not huge Hillary Clinton fans and what have you. So they were happy to run the Julian Assange interview, but it was a really fascinating, I thought, incredible interview, whether you like Assange's politics or not. So that's an example.
So, Rob Williams, we only have a few minutes left in this segment, and we wanted to make sure we got to your addition to the Chomsky-Herman media films from the propaganda model. And, of course, our listeners or listeners of this program know that it includes ownership and advertising, as well as reliance on official sources as newsmakers, flack as well, on negative criticism. There's also a built-in ideological kind of bias through capitalism and markets and so forth. But you have added five others that I think are very significant. And could you run through these briefly?
So you've named the first five. The sixth filter, and that is what I call the deep state disinformation filter. There's a lot to say about the deep state, but certainly we know that for decades now, the deep state, the Central Intelligence Agency, and other networked agencies within it have been massaging so-called U.S. news and information networks in all kinds of ways. So that's a sixth filter. The seventh filter is the algorithmic filter, in which these very powerful for-profit media corporations like Google, Facebook, Twitter, Amazon create and code these platforms. And these are designed, of course, to serve up information in ways that they deem best. The eighth filter is a term coined by MoveOn founder Eli Pariser called filter bubble. We digital media users, through our selective content and platform choices, determine the reality that surrounds us in the so-called filter bubble, and we need to sort of fight against that and push outside of the realm of our bubbles. I think that's really important. The ninth filter, wonderful phrase, behavioral micro-targeting. And this surfaced during the election last fall when we saw Cambridge Analytica, based in London, talk about massaging 220 million American voters with 5,000 pieces of individual data on each of them through a lot of these digital media platforms in the months and weeks prior to the election. It's hard to know how accurate and how much reach this organization has with behavioral micro-targeting, but suffice to say, I think it played more of a role in massaging electoral outcomes than people realize. So we need to look at that as a filter because it's pretty prevalent and it's coming on. And then finally, my favorite, the 10th filter is what we call sock puppets. And these are fake and often anonymous social media accounts that are unleashed into digital and social media spaces from corporations or governments designed to attack or support particular ideas, candidates, positions, platforms, campaigns. Some of your listeners may be familiar with the TV show Homeland, but there's a whole interesting subplot in the latest season of Homeland that had to do with the CIA and a secret sock puppet office that was kind of at work behind the scenes on social media, really trying to game the outcome. So those are the five new filters that we have proposed that we think about when we think about the propaganda model of news for the digital age.
Indeed, Rob Williams, and we agree, as you write, our best solution to fighting fake news and fomenting real news is an interdisciplinary one with the teaching of critical thinking, history, writing, and multimedia production at its core. And, of course, at Global Critical Media Literacy Project, Project Censored, ACME, so many of us in this community really working toward this. And, you know, now is really our time to shine, I think, Rob Williams. And now I believe our work is more important than ever, particularly given the last five filters that we are inundated with in this age of digital disorientation. Rob Williams, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored show today. We will certainly be revisiting these topics, and we'd love to have you back on the air to talk about them more specifically in the near future.
Mickey and Peter, thanks for your work, and we'll talk again soon.
After this brief musical break, we will return to the Project Censored show in an interview with Abby Martin. Stay with us.
Welcome to the Holy City, a silver screen built with a lens and a low self-esteem. A teenager's plea for meaning and means, we're selling the news. The opinions are easier to swallow than facts. The grays instead of the whites and the blacks. If you shoot it too straight, they won't come back. We're selling the news. See, money speaks volumes louder than words. With virtues, with wings, maybe not quite at first. But salaries are paid by the ads, not the birds. We're selling the news. Dog who's been chasing his tail. The lowest common denominator prevails. We're selling the news. I wanna believe you. I wanna believe, but everything is in between. The fact is fiction. The fact is fiction. I wanna believe you. I wanna believe, but everything is in between. The fact is fiction. Suspicion is a new religion.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. In this segment of the program, we are going to continue our conversation fighting fake news, media propaganda, and we're going to get more specific on some of these cases. We are very pleased to welcome back to the program journalist Abby Martin, host of the Empire Files on Telesur and also with Media Roots. And we're going to hear more also about her recent dispatches from her trip to Venezuela. Abby Martin, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks so much, Mickey and Peter. Great to be on.
So we were speaking with Rob Williams earlier in the program about the phenomenon of fake news and propaganda and the importance of critical media literacy education to deconstruct that, to understand more clearly and have people be able to consume news in a way that involves critical analysis. And as a journalist, for us at Project Censored, we think you epitomize what's best about journalistic principles because you do seek truth and you do go and shine light in dark places to tell the stories that others won't tell. And at the same time, you can't help but cast shadows on, you call out fake news reports. And this doesn't mean you're using the term in the way that people like Donald Trump will use it as a weaponized term to shout down critics. But just because of the integrity of your work, you obviously make it problematic for corporate media narratives. And your most recent work in Venezuela is a classic example of how that's going on. So, Abby Martin, tell us about your latest work and what you've been learning and how that goes against the corporate narrative and State Department narrative we hear in the U.S. about Venezuela.
It's incredible, you guys. I mean, as a media analyst and critic for the last 10 years, you think that you've seen it all, right? You think that you know how to dissect propaganda when you kind of see it coming out of your face, when it's coming just churning out ad nauseum, right, from all of these corporate media outlets, and not even corporate media outlets, a lot of leftist media outlets are echoing the same kind of regime change propaganda in regards to Venezuela. But wow, you really almost have to go on the ground to see just how egregious the lies and propaganda is. And I think it's probably the same with Syria. You know, you're embedded with these rebel fighters, and so you kind of apologize for Al-Qaeda, or you end up doing that. But when it comes to Venezuela, it seems like a lot of these outlets just echo the opposition's line and don't go on the ground and actually see for themselves what's going on and how nuanced the situation really is. So I'll talk about what we see. Of course, in the Western media, we see this repressive dictatorship, right, where Venezuela's become a totalitarian state, where Maduro's holding on to power. He's mowing down peaceful protesters in the street with these state forces. So, of course, the supermarkets are empty, you know, widespread starvation. People are breaking into zoos to eat the animals. So, of course, we go there expecting just complete in total chaos on the ground with all of these things to be true. And what we saw was actually the complete opposite. There is no widespread famine. Yes, people are eating less and worse now than in recent years because of an overarching economic war. A lot of people think that this is a socialist failure, right? Well, the economy is actually a trifold community, private, and state. So you look at where the shortage is coming from. How is this economic war being played out? Yes, you can't get toilet paper at some of these stores, but then you can get paper towels and napkins and Kleenex. So why is that? You start to realize that things aren't as they seem, that some of these companies have actually exacerbated the crisis by preventing loans. And a lot of these companies are working hand in hand with the opposition. So the economic war going on is very real. It's very strong. It's causing staple goods to be completely gone from the shelves, put in the black market. The companies claim that it's because the government is setting price controls that they can't sell these goods. So that's really the crux of the economic crisis. We talk to people in the street. We say, are you starving? You know, we see in the Western media that you guys are starving and begging on the streets and digging through trash, and they just say, no, that's completely untrue. There's an economic war going on in the media's line. When it comes to the protests, it's very curious as well, because the media completely obfuscates the class nature of these protests. It is completely black and white. The protests on the street are the upper middle class, wealthy people who can afford more food, right? But they use the poor cynically to say that we're starving, we need intervention. These people are the upper middle class people who kind of lost their power, their stronghold on the economy once Chavez got into power. As we know, Chavez and then Maduro, his successor, has won democratically. Jimmy Carter called them the most democratic elections in the world, about 17 elections straight. And so it wasn't until the opposition took power of one of the branches of government in 2015 that we started to see the economic crisis really exacerbate. And when you see this death toll being tossed around about the protests. There's, you know, 140 dead in the streets of Caracas. You realize that there are huge peaceful protests going on all the time from pro-government people, from pro-opposition people. But you see this death toll, and it's actually happening on the front lines of these things called the guarimbas. It's a sustained, violent blockade. We followed one around all night. They commandeered trucks. They lit burning barricades on the freeway. I mean, they're directly provoking these state forces. And, of course, altercations are going to happen. We are doing this day after day, throwing Molotov cocktails, planting explosives. The character of this protest movement is fascist and violent. They have burned people alive who are allegedly Chavista and black. This has happened plenty of times. Two people have already died from their burns, but they threatened to lynch me. They've threatened Global Vision journalists. They've doused them with gasoline. This is no joke. I can't think of another fascistoid characteristic of a political movement other than maybe the KKK or the neo-Nazis in Ukraine that use the tactic of burning alive political opponents. So it's a very serious situation, and unfortunately, everyone from Vice to CNN glorifies the hell out of these protesters and doesn't talk about what will happen. What will happen if the U.S. overthrows a democratically elected sovereign government and this opposition gets in power? What will happen? Will we see a Pinochet-style dictatorship, a mass privatization of all the Chavista programs? It's very scary that no one talks about the bigger picture here, guys.
Abby, thank you. It's clear that the corporate media continually labels the government as a dictatorship, which is absolute lie. It's completely false. There's been great elections there all along, and they just had an election for a constitutional assembly, which the right claims that they boycotted the election, but some 8 million people voted in this assembly, and they're trying to rewrite their constitution to make sure that the extreme right doesn't take power and ultimately control what's happening there. At the same time, the price of oil, of course, dropped, and that was manipulated by the Saudis and the U.S. globally. Venezuela was undermined in terms of their income from oil substantially, but they still have oil, they're still selling that, and they're continuing in that capacity. So these are important understandings. Now, the supermarket story, the New York Times had a picture of an empty supermarket with a woman shopping there, and it was like a given. This is the supermarkets in Caracas. And you're saying that's false. I know that that's false. So it's really an amazing lie. But it's a lie orchestrated through the corporate media globally from the State Department and surely public relation firms and propaganda firms that work for the State Department and are putting out these lies. They're packaged them.
Yeah, so, and you know, we're talking about a movement that has tried to gain power through undemocratic means ever since Chavez took power. I mean, there was a U.S.-backed coup in 2002 where Chavez was kidnapped for 3 days. I mean, the opposition completely destroyed the Constitution when they got in power. They didn't bother with the nicety of trying to provide some feigned democratic leadership. They eviscerated it. And in 2014, we saw the same thing. I mean, they staged coups, coup after coup, violent uprising after violent uprising, where they're actually encouraging people to burn down buildings. Again, the protesters, as much as they use the starvation and famine as this tool to gain international sympathy, they are burning down food distribution warehouses. They just burned down a warehouse full of 50 tons of food, attacking maternity clinics, seizing hospitals and schools. So there is something very, very disturbing about the character of the protesters. And Peter, you mentioned the Constituent Assembly, and I think that's a really great point, because here you have the opposition boycotting it, right? A couple weeks prior, they had their own kind of fake referendum, which, of course, there were no ballots counted. You can count, you voted multiple times, as the Telesur undercover investigation showed. The media took that count at face value. 7 million people voted to boycott the Constituent Assembly. Yet they all boycotted the actual election several weeks later. And when you look at that outcome, 8 million people showed up. 8 million people. That is astounding. In a country of 30 million people, for 8 million people to come vote to support that process, right, to support this movement, this Chavista movement that is alive and well and cannot be ruled without this vision incorporated. And that's what the opposition wants to do. It's a fascist vision where they want to rule without Chavismo, without taking the poor in account, with a mass privatization. And that's exactly what the Constituent Assembly was doing. It was supposed to protect the missions, these dozens of missions that have been employed, free healthcare, free education, free housing. They want to protect these things because they are very worried, again, what will happen if the opposition takes power, because it could be very, very ugly, and they know that they need to mobilize to show their strength. And unfortunately, you have the media here just calling it a fraud, you know, calling it a lie. It's absolutely absurd. Every election that they have, you can audit the vote. They have paper ballots. It's way more transparent than the U.S.
Yeah, indeed it is. But you're also describing a similar problem with the U.S. regarding the press and the control of information and propaganda that is seemingly quite pervasive there.
Oh, my God. That's another thing we hear, right? Maduro controls all the press. Maduro jails all political opponents, shuts down all these media outlets that are critical of him. Look, yes, a media outlet, their license wasn't renewed because they were calling to kill the president during one
right.
of the coup attempts 10 years prior. Okay, let's look at the newspapers. I went around Caracas and bought up 10 different newspapers. What was the breakdown? Actually, it was way more diverse than the United States. As we know, the corporate media essentially just echoes state propaganda. It might as well be state media. In Caracas, 8 out of the 10 papers were extremely critical of Maduro. One even said Trump must take care of Maduro. Another one showed Vladimir Padrino, the defense minister, saying that blood is on your hands of all the protesters. Can you imagine? Even police officers that kill black people with total impunity here, can you imagine blaming Trump for that and saying that blood is on your hands, Trump, for all the black unarmed men who were killed by police? So the narrative is very different, and it's the same actually on TV when you break down the Nielsen rating and the amount that is captured in terms of the audience of state versus private media. You're looking at only about 9% audience tuning into state media on TV. So it is a gross exaggeration. And really, we hear that time and again. You know, the countries that they claim, that the Western media claims has no free press, usually has hugely free press.
Certainly relative to the United States that operates under the illusion of a free press. And, of course, Mark Crispin Miller called that out with aerial quotes in the foreword to our last book, Our Free Press. Well, Abby Martin, tell us a little bit more about what you're doing with the program Empire Files and a little bit more about what you have in store for people and where they get more information.
So we did a huge series on Palestine. We did this series on Venezuela, really the hot spots where I feel like the media is completely failing and working on behalf of the U.S. empire. And I'm talking about leftist alternative media as well, really failing on this issue on Venezuela. So we really wanted to provide that nuance, the complexities to that, and really break through the disinformation. And that's what this show really is. Not only is it breaking through the propaganda and disinformation about these issues, you know, the catastrophic wars on multiple fronts that the U.S. empire is facing and Trump is exacerbating, turbocharging the empire, but it's also providing that voice, right, to the marginalized and oppressed people who haven't been able to write history themselves. History has been written by the winners, and we're retelling these lost chapters of American history and things that have happened today to put in the perspective of empire and how it's shaped the world and really bring out these voices of resistance that have been completely censored throughout the years. So it's a beautiful project. We're completely independent. It's really amazing to just have complete editorial freedom and produce whatever we want. We're actually going to Houston 1 month later when all the media vultures and parasites are gone out of people's faces and really analyzing what happened and what needs to be done a month later after the dust settles. So we're looking forward to that coverage, and everyone can check it out on theempirefiles.tv.
What's the website again, Abby?
Theempirefiles.tv. Okay. And mediaroots.org.
So, Abby, in the United States, we've seen a strange brew here this past year with the labeling of fake news and how the term has been weaponized by Trump. But it's strange because it really works as a distraction away from the problem we have in the corporate state media here and corporate slash state, a State Department press release or PR industry that controls news here. There really is a fake news problem here, and it's not just satire, and it's not just a weaponized term. It's the fact that we do lack diversity in our media, and we do have hegemonic narratives in the corporate media here, and even in alternative media outlets, including the left media, we lack significant diversity and openness of discussion. But it's that weaponization of the term. And if you go back in history, like the Lügenpresse, right, back in Germany, World War I, World War II, where it's the lying press was a weaponized phrase. So, you know, this is not new. And if we want to really look at real fake news, perhaps we should be looking at CIA involvement in media and deep state involvement. I know that term's been run through the ringer this past year, but going back and looking at media control, Given your experience and certainly the narratives that you write about, what are your views on this conundrum that we find ourselves?
Well, it's quite a conundrum, Mickey, because as you just mentioned, the president has weaponized the term to now just have his base of neo-fascists trust only the news that worships him, right? And this kind of crazy propagandistic Breitbart-style Drudge Report aggregation that just exacerbates racial tensions and horrible sentiment against minorities. So that's one thing, extremely dangerous, right? And I see people every day sharing literal fake news stories from your newswire.com, et cetera, just making stuff up about Trump. They all live in a tiny echo chamber, but your point is very well made about the larger problem of fake news. I mean, how do we get into every war that we've gotten into? New York Times, the purveyor of fake news. Washington Post, the purveyor of fake news. I mean, these are supposed papers of the Beltway, right? The paper of record setting the news of the state. And unfortunately, they lie time and again, exaggerate time and again. Look at Judith Miller. How does she still have a job? This woman should be shamed. She should be in jail. She has the blood of a million Iraqis on her hand. The fact that these people are paraded on the media, David Frum, Eric Prince, given an op-ed in the New York Times talking about how we need to privatize the war in Afghanistan. It's already privatized. So, yes, it's amazing and astounding when you see publications like the New York Times and the Washington Post trying to say what is and what is not fake news. And then when you look at the nitty-gritty, what they're trying to call fake news is essentially all non-corporate funded media. So really, it all goes down in the attack on leftist grassroots alternative media, the organizations that are doing the real work, right? Project Censored, Truth Dig, Counterpunch. And it is a very concerted effort. There's even a new think tank, the PNAC 3.0, coming up that really is only focusing on fake news. You see the attack on RT. It wasn't necessarily about hacking the election. It was about putting out contradictory news that they don't want to put out there.
And you also were to blame somehow, even though you hadn't had a show there for years.
Yeah, I mean, I was in the DNI report because it shows you exactly what they're most scared of. They're most scared of real reporting and real truth-telling. And that's what this new think tank is about. It's about discrediting organizations like RT and organizations that get out information that they do not want people to know. And when half the country is living in poverty, I think it's damn right they're right to know.
And indeed, you know, Trump ran a campaign as a war on the press, shouting lock them up as journalists. And then he weaponized fake news, taking it out of the mouths of the DNC, per se. And then also that kind of hostility to the press went all the way up to the House race in Montana with Greg Gianforte beating up a Guardian reporter, Ben Jacobs, literally because he didn't want to answer his questions and, in fact, pleaded guilty to even doing this. Of course, he was seated as representative in Montana anyway, because this apparently is the United States where we don't have a free press. But at any rate, you know, just on a concluding point, it's clear that Trump and his supporters don't care about journalism or a free press, you know, or for that matter, an informed populace in a Democratic Republic. And all these histrionics, they're hard to keep up with all the tweeting and things. These really illustrate that it's long past time to insist that we have a robust and critical free press. We exercise it, one that actually fights back, not with snide antics and playground politics where CNN kind of gets into a fistfight and gets into the wrestling ring with Trump, but with actual real investigative reporting that holds the administration accountable for policies and actions, not personality politics, not reality TV, right? And that's, of course, what we see here in the United States, and that's why the corporate press is failing. Ever more time for independent, viable press like yours, Abby Martin, and the Empire File. So we can't thank you enough for the great work that you do.
Thank you so much, you guys. You guys rock.
Thank you so much, Abby. We will definitely be catching up with you in the near future. Coming up after this musical break, we'll speak with the Associate Director of Project Censored, Dr. Andy Lee Roth, about the newest book we put together from Project Censored called Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World. Stay with us.
Well, it seems like the whole damn world's gone wrong. St. Joe McCarthy is dead and gone. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Don't try to change my mind with facts. To hell with the graduated income tax. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Daily News. Daily Blues. Pick up a copy anytime you choose. Seven little pennies in the newsboy's hand, and you ride right along to Never Never Land. You know, John Paul Getty is just plain folks. The UN Charter is a cruel hoax. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. J. Edgar Hoover is the man of the hour. All that he needs is just a little more power. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Daily News, Daily Blues. up a copy anytime you choose. Seven little pennies in the newsboy's hand, and you ride right along to Never Never Land.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. Today's show, we've been focusing on all things media. We've been talking about the propaganda model in a digital age. Of course, we heard from Rob Williams. We've also heard from Abby Martin and discussed her program, The Empire Files, and the importance of a free press in our times. We're now joined by Associate Director of Project Censored, my partner in crime in the Censored Annual Books published by Seven Stories Press. We're joined by Dr. Andy Lee Roth. Andy is co-editor with me of Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World. Andy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's so great to be on the air with you, Mickey.
Indeed. And Andy, of course, you've co-hosted with us and you've been on the show a number of times. And here we are again, another year. And yes, it is another book from Project Censored. And why don't you tell listeners briefly a little bit about this year's book that's coming out on October 3rd?
Well, as you've mentioned, Mickey, the subtitle of the book is Press Freedoms in a, quote, post-truth, end quote, world. And so one of the major themes of the book that runs across all the way from Deepa Kumar's foreword through our introduction and through a number of the substantive chapters is this idea of what does it mean to say we live in a post-truth world? The Oxford dictionaries defined post-truth as describing circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. So what does it mean to talk about the role of journalism and the importance of press freedoms in a world that for many people is defined by this condition of being, quote, post-truth? And part of the argument that I think runs as a thread throughout the book, and the reason we put post-truth in quotations, is that we at Project Censored are not ready to accept that condition as a given, as the new normal, and so forth, that we're pushing back against that idea, as are the many contributors to this year's volume.
Indeed, Andy, that is true. And you mentioned Deepa Kumar, who's at Rutgers, a scholar, author. We've worked with Deepa Kumar before, and this year she graced our book with a fabulous foreword that really begins the Censored 2018 book talking about the Oxford Dictionary post-truth phenomenon and conundrum, and also riffs on another favorite theme of ours, that of the importance of academic freedom and the importance for all subjects to be addressed, to be taught without impunity. And certainly this year's book, Censored 2018, addresses those in the top 25 through the news abuse chapters. Also this year, you and I have an addition that was not in any of the previous books. We have a graphic chapter. Do you want to talk to listeners a little bit about that or some of the other contents here?
The graphic chapter that we have, we've been working for several years to have a chapter in that format as part of the annual yearbook, and we succeeded this year. A fantastic piece with the text by Adam Bessie out at Diablo Valley College and illustrations by Peter Glanting. And of course, we're on the radio now, so we can't show you imagery, but it's possible to talk about some of the influences and some of the name checks in this Trump Universe chapter. They draw on the visual vocabulary of Jack Kirby's Galacticus and Doctor Doom. They're invoking Ursula Le Guin and name-checking Rod Serling's Twilight Zone and George Orwell's 1984. But all of this, without stealing the thunder of this really moving chapter, is, although it may seem like Trump Universe is a Twilight Zone science fiction type of universe, their argument is that the story is one that can undergo a massive rewrite, and their whole graphic chapter is in some ways a call for us to engage in that significant revision of the storyline.
Indeed, it is. And again, we invite listeners to go to our website, projectcensored.org. Not only are all of our archives there from the radio for nearly 7 years, but our top stories dating back to our founding year in 1976. Our guest is Andy Lee Roth, the Associate Director of Project Censored, and also the co-editor here of Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a, quote, post-truth, end quote, world. Andy Roth, since we were just riffing on images, tell us a little bit about the cover of this year's book. In the intro, we write about Umberto Eco, a democratic civilization will save itself only if it makes the language of the image into a stimulus for critical reflection, not an invitation for hypnosis.
Right. So And when Umberto Eco wrote that back in 1979, he was thinking of television screens. But, of course, now we carry small-scale screens with us all the time, and we interface with images nearly 24/7 through our various tablets and handheld devices, which brings to relevance the image that is the cover of our book here this year. We're so lucky to have worked again with Hillary Allison, who did the cover for the Censor 2016 book. And this year she's given us an image that I think is so powerful and contemporary. The scene is a living room. On the screen of the big screen TV in the living room is a raging fire. On the mantelpiece above the screen showing the fire, there are no fewer than 3 fire extinguishers. And so the imagery I have is of a household that has followed the agenda set by the media as broadcast across their TV. Fire is danger. Fire is a danger. But the image, as Hillary Allison has created it, is one of the living room is actually being flooded. So the danger coming to us over the screen is of one element, fire, and the preparation has been made appropriately for that particular threat. But the real actual danger is another element, water, in the form of flooding. So we talked in our introduction about the richness of this image, and just to pick up one dimension of that, of course it was Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451 that featured this idea of the public being distracted from impending war by the wall-sized screens that bombarded them with nonsense. And in this case, I think Hillary Allison's imagery resonates with that notion from Bradbury's classic. But the danger of fire in the circumstances of global warming is a real one. It's not that the screen is broadcasting nonsense. It's that the screen is setting an agenda or misdirecting the public's attention from what's really going on. And of course, that's a theme that resonates with this idea of, well, do we live in a post-truth world? If it is a post-truth world, how should we best respond, and so forth.
Indeed, and we do respond with the top 25 stories, and certainly in the introduction where we riff around a great quote from the Indian writer Rabindranath Tagore that is, truth comes as a conqueror only because we have lost the art of receiving it as guest, to riff on the post-truth theme. So, Andy Roth, we have about 2 minutes left here in the segment. Could you give our listeners a couple teasers maybe about some of the other things that are in Censored 2018?
Well, you know, one of the things, I don't want to give away too much about this year's top 25 list, except maybe to just tease this one out a little bit. In a period of time going back to the 2016 elections, where we've been inundated by politicians, pundits, and the like about fake news this and fake news that, one of the top stories that we've been tracking this past year and that will feature in this year's top 25 list, a story originally reported by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism out of the UK, out of London, is that the Pentagon paid a UK PR firm millions of dollars over a period of years to produce and distribute fake Al-Qaeda videos. So without going into the details of that story, which will be featuring much more prominently in the upcoming weeks as the book is released, in a year when pundits and politicians of all stripes across the political spectrum, as well as members of the public and the establishment press, were crowing over fake news, this is one of the stories that went in completely underreported, unacknowledged in the U.S. corporate media. And it's only because of independent investigative journalistic outlets like the Bureau of Investigative Journalism that we know about how one of the most powerful U.S. government institutions, the Department of Defense, secretly used taxpayer money to create fake news of its own.
Indeed, and that is a very powerful story and statement, and there are many, many other similar themes and stories in Censored 2018, out by Seven Stories Press, October 3rd, so get your copy when you can. And the rest of the book, of course, we have Media Democracy in Action with our friends at the Index on Censorship and Tribeworthy and others, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We have our colleagues Nolan Higdon, Nicholas Baham III on the New American Authoritarianism and Normalized Racism. Elizabeth Blakey has a fabulous chapter on defamation as censorship in the social media era. We also have some really heavy hitters, Edward Herman from the Propaganda Model fame, Still manufacturing consent, the propaganda model of 30, and Ralph Nader talks about breaking through power and the mass media blackout of his Super Bowl of citizen action. So it's a chock-full book, Censored 2018. Andy Lee Roth, Associate Director of Project Censored, co-editor with me of Censored 2018. Andy, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored show today.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you, Mickey.
That was a conversation with the Associate Director of Project Censored, Dr. Andy Lee Roth. I'm Mickey Huff, and the book that Andy and I were just talking about is our latest from Seven Stories Press. It's Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World. These are the top censored stories and media analysis for the years 2016 and 17. Noam Chomsky has said of Project Censored's work, it's a crucial contribution to the hope for a more just and democratic society. Did you know that over 1,000 communities in the United States are experiencing lead contamination at quadruple the rates found in Flint, Michigan? Or that the U.S. Army has accumulated $6.5 trillion in expenditures that cannot be accounted for? What about the racially biased software used by judges to predict future crimes? Or the fossil fuel industry's influence over environmental research? Haven't heard the news? Well, neither did the rest of the world, and that's because these and countless other news items are suppressed or ignored by our nation's so-called free press every day. For the past 42 years, Project Censored has been unearthing the buried stories that corporate media deem unfit to print and debunking the fake news governments and corporations use to consolidate their power to promote well-informed citizen action and critical media literacy. This year's book, Censored 2018, features The New American Authoritarianism by Nolan Higdon and Nicholas Baham III, whom you recognize from being associate co-hosts of the Project Censored show and podcast. We also have a fantastic graphic chapter this year by Diablo Valley College English professor Adam Bessie, a colleague of mine, and artist Peter Glanting. It's called The Trump Universe, and it is a fantastic look at this dystopic imagery and language that we see being used around the Trump presidency. We also this year have a fantastic chapter by Elizabeth Blakey, Defamation as Censorship in the Social Media Era. This is a great chapter that talks about who has standing, who has First Amendment standing, who counts as a media defendant. We also are delighted to have Edward Herman from Herman and Chomsky's Manufacturing Consent fame. Edward Herman did a chapter for us called Still Manufacturing Consent, The Propaganda Model at 30. And Ralph Nader rounds out Censored 2018 with Breaking Through Power. He talks about how his events in Washington, D.C. were the subject of a media blackout, even though it was a Super Bowl of citizen action. All of that and more in Censored 2018, the top censored stories of the past year, junk food news, news abuse, and media democracy in action. And again, that is a great way for us to kind of finalize today's show, which was based on media, media literacy, critical media literacy, and the fights against censorship. Again, I'm Mickey Huff, and this is the Project Censored show. I'm just going to tell you a few other things that you can find in the pages of Censored 2018. Again, there's a lot of contents in Censored 2018 that you'll likely hear over the course of the next several months, as we'll be interviewing the people, the intrepid journalists, the independent press, who have covered the important stories that we need to know about. And not only are they in the book and online and published originally, of course, at the outlets where they write and work, we, of course, link all of the original articles and urge you to support these kind of independent outlets. Again, Censored 2018, Andy Lee Roth, myself, Mickey Huff with Project Censored are the editors. We have a fantastic foreword by Deepa Kumar, the scholar from Rutgers University who writes on Islamophobia. Khalil Bendib, once again, has fantastic cartoons that add to the book. And just, again, a couple more teasers for you to go out and pick up a copy of this.
We have stories on big data and dark money behind the 2016 election that have a lot more to do with the outcome than so-called fake news. We have another story on voter suppression. Again, far more likely that this has to do with the outcome of the election along with the Electoral College than fake news. A blockbuster story on Pentagon-paid United Kingdom public relations firms making fake Al-Qaeda videos. The Pentagon paid a UK PR firm to make fake Al-Qaeda videos talking about fake news. We also have record year of global internet shutdowns. We also have Shell Oil understanding that climate change was a problem with their industry as early as 1991, and they chose to ignore it. And we also have some good news stories about how young plaintiffs invoke constitutional grounds for climate protection. So these, again, are fantastic stories in the book, 8 Use of Force Policies to Prevent Killings by Police. So again, there's a lot going on in the book, including Media Democracy for Action with our friends at Triberthy. Also some pieces by Kevin Gastolia and Rana Kalik at Unauthorized Disclosure, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Rachel Jolly, and the Index on Censorship. Again, Censor 2018, out now, Seven Stories Press. To learn more, go to projectcensor.org.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. The Project Censored Show airs on 40 stations around the U.S., from Maui to New York. Peter and I are executive producers and co-hosts. Anthony Fest, our producer. Erica Bridgman, our engineer. To learn more about the Project Censored Show and our parent nonprofit Media Freedom Foundation, go to projectcensored.org. To hear our past programs and special Project Censored podcasts with our associate hosts, Nolan Higdon, Nick Bayham, and Desiree McSwain, go to projectcensored.org/radio. Click on our podcast on our Patreon page. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We'll see you next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Marilyn Waring on Sex, Lies, and Global Economics. This film was a secret favorite for those who wanted to decode the economic system of perpetual destructive growth, and for those who looked for an intelligent explanation of the connection between economics and war. Now, finally, it has become accessible on the Internet on the website of the National Film Board of Canada at www.nfb.ca. Look under Marilyn Waring, the real star of the documentary by Terry Nash. Marilyn Waring was only 22 when she was first elected to the New Zealand Parliament. Re-elected 3 times, she soon became chair of the prestigious Public Expenditures Committee, the sole Budget, Appropriations, Public Accounts Committee of Parliament. She was shocked and dismayed when she learned that all countries that are members of the United Nations, practically the whole world, are forced to keep their books and design their budgets under the system of national income accounting, which records monetary transactions as gross domestic product. Marilyn Waring said in part one that the GDP system counts only cash transactions in the market. In other words, it recognizes no value other than money. This means there is no value to peace, to the preservation of the environment, and no value to unpaid work. The system leaves out half the population of the planet and the planet itself, she says. This segment begins with war. Under the GDP accounting system, war is the biggest growth industry of all. when John Maynard Keynes and Richard Stone invented the GDP formula during World War II, they explicitly designed it as a system of how to pay for the war, end quote. This British system was imposed on the world in 1953. No country may be a member of the UN, deal with the IMF or World Bank unless they do their national accounting based on the GDP. And some say that unlimited growth along with globalization has driven the wars and environmental destruction of the past 50-plus years. In spite of the magnitude of the problem with growth and GDP accounting, there is an encouraging aspect. If a global system can be designed by two economists, Mr. Keynes and Mr. Stone, and if it can get imposed not so long ago, in 1953, it is possible and necessary to design a different system and set a date for change in the near future. Here is Marilyn Waring in the soundtrack of the film about her, Who's Counting? Sex, Lies, and Global Economics. After addressing the issue of war, she presents some of her ideas for a replacement system to the GDP.
The international trade in arms is the biggest growth industry of all.
Scout aircraft are acquiring targets at day or night, work in Desert Storm.
The five permanent members of the Security Council are also the five leading arms exporters in the world.
Out beyond 10 kilometers, mass-mounted sight.
Killing people, or preparing to kill them, is considered very valuable in the international economic system. Arms exports account for more than half the trade surplus of the developed economies. But the death, homelessness, injury, poverty and starvation caused by the use of these weapons is not even registered as a deficit.
If a country develops an economic system that is based on how to pay for the war, and if the amounts of fixed capital investment that are apparent are tied up in armaments, and if that country is a major exporter of arms and its industrial fabric is dependent on them, then it would be in that country's interests to ensure that it always had a market. It is not an exaggeration to say that it is clearly in the interests of the world's leading arms exporters to make sure that there is always a war going on somewhere.
Every minute, 30 children die from want of food and inexpensive vaccines. And every minute, the world's military budget absorbs $1.3 million of the public treasury. This is war. The United States now devotes over $200 billion a year to military defense against foreign enemies. But 45% of Americans are afraid to go out alone at night within 1 mile of their homes. This is war. For every 100,000 people in the world, there are 556 soldiers, but only 85 doctors. This is war. For every soldier, the average world military expenditure is $22,000. For every school-aged child, the average public education expenditure is $380. This is war. The cost of a single new nuclear submarine equals the annual education budget of 23 developing countries with 160 million school-aged children. This is war. War is marketable. War pays, literally. War contributes to growth and development. Philippines can be seen as a microcosm of the entire developing world. These are the hills overlooking the port city of Cebu in the southern part of the Philippines. It's a rural area which has been left vacant by an absentee landowner. A group of families have moved onto this land and built their huts and established a community here. Most of the men only get sporadic jobs, or they provide cheap labour for some of the large cash crop plantations around the country. So it's really up to the women themselves to provide for the children. The average Filipino woman has 8 children to raise and no access to abortion, family planning, or divorce. You can imagine the anxiety that a mother of 8 must feel if she doesn't know where she's going to get enough food to feed them all every day. This is the reason that women in rural areas all over the world grow food crops or raise farm animals. This sort of farming is usually called subsistence agriculture. It doesn't involve the exchange of money, but it does ensure that these children will eat. The system of national accounts says that the domestic and personal services which don't count are the cleaning, decoration, and maintenance of the dwelling occupied by the household, the cleaning, servicing, and repair of household goods, the care of the sick, infirm, or old people, the transportation of members of the household or their goods, the preparation and serving of meals, the care, training, and instruction of children. The World Bank would argue that to change the conditions of life for these people requires export growth, to make room for productive exporting enterprises. These unproductive women and their families would simply be kicked off the land. The new company could then take further advantage of the homelessness it had helped to create by getting cheap labour here. The number of homeless children in the urban squalor of developing countries is now epidemic in its proportions. The cycle of poverty begins to repeat itself very early, as the eldest girl in a family at age 8 or 9 is expected to give up school and look after her youngest siblings, while her mother uses that time to do whatever she can to keep her family alive. Older boys may be left to fend for themselves and to sleep in the streets. Jennifer and Renren are 10-year-olds. They're just 2 of the children available through this Japanese brochure, which sells men-only tourist junkets to the Philippines. Recent studies in Thailand, which also has a lucrative business in female sexual slavery, have shown that 70% of the women and girls have become infected with the HIV virus. Those who sexually exploit children are counted as doing productive work, increasing economic growth. Even if their activities are illegal, they're considered valuable enough to be in the calculations because they're income generating. Female sexual slavery is a major growth industry worldwide. And where a multi-million dollar industry in prostitution is operating, full advantage is taken of this grinding poverty. Foreign-owned companies and a small Filipino elite own 90% of the land. In a country of 58 million people, 20 million are now homeless. Thanks to multinational monocrop plantations, the Philippines is the 14th largest exporter of food in the world. And yet 80% of the children who live here can't get enough to eat. Over 1 billion people on the planet are malnourished. In the developing countries, 50,000 people a day die from malnutrition. $17 million children in the world die each year from diseases that are related to poverty. Two-thirds of these deaths are preventable. The gross domestic product claims to measure the well-being of a country. When my friends Imelda and Loris harvest New Zealand seafood for their families, it isn't seen as economically valuable. But if they went and bought the oysters in tins at the supermarket, then that would be counted.
Before the Europeans come on, the Maoris never ever had electricity and things like that. So their food mainly depended on from the sea, was gathered from the sea. We have a custom that's called Kai Moana. Its meaning is gathering of food, mainly shellfish, from the sea. We go out when it's the tide's low and pick up seafood, mussels, oysters. The oysters take about 2 to 3 years to grow, so that's why you just take a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, we only usually take enough food for a meal, you know.
Then if you're still hungry in a couple of days, you come back and get another bucket full, and then you have them fresh all the time.
But we never sell it. The old Maoris don't sell shell food. It's not meant to be. It's meant, you know, they give it away.
You never ever sell it. You get the odd one who'll take it back to the cities to sell, but the elders usually come down hard on them and say, it's costing you nothing. And if you come and take a whole lot of food from here, then the next person that comes along to get some can't find it because you're taking it all away and selling it for money. You should leave it for food.
Well, if I'm going down to a beach to collect Kai Moana, I always behave the way that I've been taught by the local people, by the Maori people. And I find in this and in so many of the practices in Aotearoa, in New Zealand, that they make perfect sense. I mean, both perfect economic sense, perfect environmental sense, perfect ecological sense, from, you know, centuries of tradition of indigenous people. So why change it? Why behave any other way? I certainly feel in this entire journey that my constituents and then women and the ecosystem has been my teachers. Very early when I was a member of parliament, there was an application made for a prospecting license on Mount Porongia by a company called Gold Mines New Zealand. And the planning procedure was such that the mining company could show all the apparent good that was going to accrue to all of this area. We'll provide loads of jobs, we'll provide loads of support to the service infrastructures, you know, your schools will stay open, you'll get more roading, your post offices, all of those kinds of services, your electricians and plumbers and everybody else will have loads of jobs while we're involved in all of this. There'll be export earnings, it's gold we're talking about. There'll be substantial reductions in overseas funds. You know, we'll be here for years. Yeah, the usual growth development kinds of arguments. No debit side, you notice. There's never any debit side in terms of this kind of development. Nobody talking about what you're going to do with all the materials that you take out of the mountain that then begin to leach into surrounding farmland. The kind of scarring that would be happening in the bush and the forest and the mountains, the ruin of the habitat of so many species. Colin Murray was a party official in my constituency and a key member of the local farmers' organisation working against the gold mine licence.
It's a fascinating mountain because it's different every day. A little bit of cloud behind it. It was a volcano originally. It also plays a big part in our lives because it affects the weather so much. We have 90-inch rainfall here, which makes this area so good for dairying and farming generally. And that's brought about to a very, very large extent by Mount Porongia. The water around here, I have a lovely stream through the farm across the road there, and the water, the tests that the Waikato Regional Authority have done on the water, it's amongst the purest water in the country, and that's just something you can't put a value on.
Economics is a tool of people in power. I mean, economics didn't just come up from nowhere. It's a tool of those who want to exploit. It's a justification. And so as a so-called science, it doesn't allow for the introduction of values that don't find their way into a mathematical formula. It also operates in terms of language. You know, if you want to argue that mining this mountain would be devastating, you are invited to use a whole lot of words that are called soft, you know, flaky, value-laden, subjective. Economics has got it down really tight, you know, so that if you're not talking their language, if you're not talking in their jargon, you're not part of the argument, you know. So the power of economics mirrors to a great extent, you know, the political power rampant anywhere else. The economic activity that the mountain is engaged in is like 24 hours a day, never ending. It's the habitat for the pollinating species, without which none of this agriculture could survive. It's controlling the microclimate for the production that comes from everything out here. It's breathing, I mean, it's creating oxygen. None of those features can find a very easy expression in terms of cost-benefit analysis. I mean, you can't run around and say, oh, well, so much oxygen is being produced from these trees on a 24-hour basis, and the same volume of oxygen in containers in a hospital would equal, and therefore the 24-hour oxygen production of this mountain equals. Who's going to do that? This entire story so early in my political years demonstrated to me the absolute hollowness of the mathematical formula that we have to work with.
There was a tremendous uproar from the locals and plenty of meetings well attended, and with Marilyn Waring's help we managed to block the miners, so that that's not going to take place now. It's a forest reserve now. It's all that bush-clad mountain is reserved as a forest park. This here, this farming that you can see all around you, is here forever. It's not going to go away, and we're producing something far more valuable than gold. We're producing food and clothing for people, wool and so on. And, you know, mankind can do without gold, but you can't last long without food. You know, that was our argument, and I think it's the argument. This goes on forever if we look after it. It's ours for a short time while we're here on Earth, but someone else has then got to take over. And providing we look after it, it should get better and better.
It was just a local story, you know, in my constituency. But I think as an analogy, it can be expanded to the whole planet. But what are we after then? What are the alternatives?
your country, Canada or mine, New Zealand, were there a political will, could establish qualitative environmental indicators. Indicators that told us what was happening to water quality, air quality, the remaining stands of forest, the exploitation of mineral resources, the reproduction of fish species, the habitats of endangered species. There is no reason why tomorrow Canada or New Zealand could not establish time use surveys, because the one common denominator that all of us have, the one thing we might be said to choose to exchange, that is our own, is time. And time is a better description of the needs for intervention in people's lives than any other indicator. It shows you where the crisis points are. It shows you where the service needs are as a policymaker. In a study conducted by the Commission on the Status of Women in Canada, it was demonstrated that 2/3 of all primary health care took place in the home. If 2/3 of the budget for primary health care were directed towards those responsible for that care, imagine what would happen to that budget and how that budget would be redistributed and how the priorities would be turned on their head. These are the kinds of effects, in a budgetary sense, that would flow from time use surveys. Why don't policymakers or politicians or bureaucrats like this idea? Well, first of all, it's terrifying. They would have to exercise judgment. They don't have a unidimensional set of figures to which they can look and say, is growth up or down? Thereby hangs our decision. Language is a tool available to all of us. None of you, when you leave this room, should ever again say, my mother doesn't work, my wife doesn't work. That particularly relates to people who are in media or teaching positions. Push for parity. Join political parties and go to their annual conferences and year after year after year drive them crazy. Half the candidates shall be women. Half the candidates shall be women. Join this party till you get it through, then move on to the next one. I mean... Just as there is no one-way feminism, there is no one political tactic available here, there is no one political strategy. It is broad and as wide as our imaginations can take it once we have heard and seen and recognised that the emperor has no clothes. You must choose, judge, assess the strategy and tactic in your environment, in those communities that I don't have access to. Just as I do it in communities you won't have access to. I mean, the only principles are that we don't stop, that we are rigorous, that we recognise that it's hard work, and lastly and not least, that we have a lot of fun along the way.
That was the former New Zealand Member of Parliament, author and goat farmer, Marilyn Waring, in a film about her, directed by Terry Nash. The film was released in the US in 1996 and has remained a favorite for discussion groups and house parties. You can see this film online at the website of the National Film Board of Canada, www.nfb.ca. Look for Marilyn Waring. I checked on Marilyn Waring for this re-release of the radio version of the film and found her still campaigning against the GDP accounting system. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org, for the address and donate buttons. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
This is the Taylor Report. Welcome. CIUT 89.5 FM for our Canadian audience. Happy Thanksgiving for our American audience. Canadians have their Thanksgiving on October the 9th. Am I right?
Well, whatever the second,
what is it?
Whatever the second right. Monday is.
And the Americans?
The same day the Americans celebrate, you know who.
Do they?
Yeah, Columbus.
Oh, him.
Yeah.
Well, actually, there's a big argument.
About right. Yeah.
We're not doing Columbus today because he's not worthy, but we might talk about that at other times because his name is disappearing. At one time, Columbus Day, big deal. And anyway, we'll come to that. We're going to talk today with the author of Pan-Africanism and Communism, Hakim Adi. At the halfway point, we'll be talking to David Himbara about his new book, Kagame's Killing Fields. And if you listen to Taylor Report, you know where we are talking here. David Himbara served in the government of Paul Kagame. He's lucky to be alive, according to British intelligence. A lot of people have lost their lives, and recently a presidential candidate, a second woman to challenge Paul Kagame for the presidency, is brought into court, over the weekend, I believe. She is due again in court with her mother and her sister very soon. So I want to remind everybody of what it is. Rwanda, one of the dear friends of the Canadian government, very close with the American Canadian government. Phil, we have an announcement about Mr. Hakim.
Hakim
Adi.
At a different book list and cultural center. And Mr. Hakim Adi will speak on Sunday, October the 15th, that's next Sunday, at 3 p.m., Pan-Africanism and Communism with historian and author Professor Hakim Adi. And he is the author of Pan-Africanism and Communism, the Communist International, Africa and the Diaspora, 1919 and 1939. Very interesting subject.
Sunday the 15th,
3 p.m. at a different book list cultural center, 779 Bathurst Street.
Phil, thank you very much. And I believe we're joined by Dr. Hakim Adi. Are you there, sir?
I'm here. How are you doing?
Very well. We're looking forward to seeing you. This is a very important anniversary, the 1917, it's October, and I want to ask you, of course, some of the themes you're going to go into, but I would just say prior to the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, there was a world socialist movement, and you have a quote in your book by one of the leaders of that movement, an American named Eugene Debs, and he says, we really don't have
much to offer to the Negro. And then you have a second quote from a wonderful figure in American history, W.E.B. Du Bois. And he says the test of the socialist is the Negro question. But those two quotes, if I remember rightly, are separated by the event of October 1917. And the issue of race and colonial oppression was suddenly moved from the bottom of the agenda to the top of the agenda. At least I get that impression from reading your book. What do you say?
Yeah, I guess there's some truth in that. That the October Revolution of 1917 was such an earth-shattering event, the 10 days that shook the world, that nothing was quite the same again. And I think everybody had to look at the world in a different way. And that also meant for many of those organizations that called themselves socialists or particularly after 1917 communists, that they also had to look at the world in a different way. And one thing which the Russian Revolution did was to change the perception, change the importance of the anti-colonial struggle. Perhaps before that time, there had been the thinking that revolution was most likely to break out in the so-called advanced, the most advanced capitalist countries. But the analysis of Lenin and others was that the revolution may well break out where the chains of imperialism were weakest, and that could be in one of the colonial countries.
And again, this is Hakim Adi. His book is Pan-Africanism and Communism, the Communist International, Africa, and the Diaspora, 1919-1939. Wasn't it a shock for the so-called socialists, and particularly, as you say, in the so-called advanced countries, that this Lenin represented the old international notion of human equality, that there wasn't a group or nationality or color of people who had to be raised and educated by white Europeans?
Yeah, that's quite right. And as I was saying earlier, this idea that only revolutions in the advanced countries or revolutions in the advanced capitalist countries were more important than anti-colonial revolutions, or that the struggles of workers of European origin were more important than struggles of workers of African or Asian origin. That notion, I think, was put into the dustbin of history, as it were. And Lenin and the Bolsheviks' analysis was that the anti-colonial struggles, the anti-imperialist struggles, were part of the world revolutionary struggle, were just as important. And when the Communist International was formed in 1919, it definitely took that approach, that the workers of all countries were equal. There were no advanced workers and backward workers in that sense. The struggles of all countries were, and all peoples were, important and needed to be organized accordingly. And of course, that approach, which an inherent part of it was anti-racism, if you like, that approach led to many from Africa, from the diaspora, African-Americans, those Africans who were based in Europe, as well as in the African continent, the Caribbean and elsewhere, many gravitated towards the Russian Revolution and the new socialist state that was being constructed in the Soviet Union. Yeah. And earlier you mentioned W.B. Du Bois. He was one of those who visited the Soviet Union in 1926. So when he returned, he said that if this is Bolshevism, if this is what I've seen with my own eyes, if this is Bolshevism, then I'm a Bolshevik. And many others had similar experiences and expressed similar views about the Soviet Union, which of course was the result of the October Revolution in 1917.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I notice, and your book points out, is that they had a strategy. They addressed directly the issue of at the time they used the word Negro participation, black participation in the parties, the recruitment, it became an order. That is, they were not going to tolerate excuses for the non-recruitment and emphasis on the super exploited workers of the Caribbean, South Africa, and United States, particularly I noticed in your book.
Yes, I mean, that's true. The book looks at those parties which had particular responsibilities, you could say, because they had they were connected either with colonies in Africa and the Caribbean, say, so communist parties in Britain or France, as well as those which were located in Africa and had, again, particular responsibilities, like the party in South Africa or like the communist party in the United States. And many of those parties, or several of those parties, for different reasons, were reluctant to or slow to take up these particular questions for solution. One of the principles of the Communist International, in fact, one of the all communist parties had to be in opposition to the imperialism of their own ruling class, if you like. So they had to take a stand against a colonialism. The British Party had to take a stand against a colonial rule in throughout the British Empire and organize accordingly. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the parties were reluctant or slow to do that.
Some of them really balked, as you document in the book. They really doubted that was the best policy. They rather weighted down with the ideas of the colonial bosses of their countries.
Yeah, they were slow for various reasons, or they didn't organize amongst the African or Caribbean populations which existed in Britain or France or wherever. And in the U.S. party, there were also a whole range of problems. These were young communist organizations that had all kinds of problems to overcome, including political problems and so on. Mm-hmm. But yes, the Communist International endeavored to resolve these problems, to make sure that, as far as was possible, the Communist Party did take up the colonial question for solution, or in the United States, as you say, what was then called the Negro question. So it was important that the oppression of African Americans was taken up for solution, that African Americans were recruited, were in the leadership of the parties, and so on. Mm-hmm. And similarly with the party in South Africa, which initially started off as a party whose membership was mainly of European origin and leadership was of European origin. And the Communist International was most insistent that a communist party in Africa must be a party mainly of Africans, people of African origin, and its leadership must also be of that origin. And also its politics must reflect the problems of that country, which were that, you know, Africans were denied the right to govern themselves and so on. So the Communist Party in South Africa was instructed to deal with those problems, to change its leadership, to change its political orientation, and so on. Mm-hmm. And these were things which were undertaken through discussions in the congresses of the Communist International, and so on. So it was setting an example. It was one of the few organizations in that period which took a stand against colonialism, which took a stand against racism, and which endeavored to make sure that these questions were resolved, or set up specific organizations to deal with them. And the book charts the history of one of those organizations, the International Trade Union Committee of Negro Workers, which was set up to both to organize black workers and to assist the various communist parties to take up these questions and solve them.
Yeah, I must say I really appreciated that discussion in the book. Incidentally, it's terrifically footnoted. I once had the opportunity to talk to W.H. Auden, and I asked him if he read Marx, and he said, the footnotes, I love the footnotes. And this has a bunch of wonderful footnotes as well. But the author is Hakim Adi, a doctor. He's going to be here in Toronto on Sunday the 15th at 3 o'clock at a different book list. When I say you're going to be via Skype, I believe.
That's true. I'm not going to be there in the flesh, but I will be there through the wonders of modern technology and Skype.
The pure intellectual product, the thing itself, in essence. I want to ask you lastly, or just say to you, that in your book, and you include, thank you very much, a lot of wonderful pictures of people I've heard about over the years and never seen them or rarely seen any photographs of them. Just terrific people who left a great mark on history. And you also refer to so many wonderful publications of that time. And to me, it was just remarkable that so many great American writers, and I'm speaking of the diaspora, the black writers of America, here they were editing and putting out terrific publications, in my view, probably ought to be in our hands yet in some series or something, because you'd say someone like Claude McKay or Langston Hughes, there are names that come to mind, but they really had a terrific collection of, I don't know how many of their journals reached the hands of those they were directed toward, but I assume that there was a readership. Your book emphasizes how well engaged they were with their public.
Yeah, I think that's true. There were a whole range of publications. I mean, certainly in the U.S. and one can see the kind of fruit of that work, not just publications, but the organizing work that took place. I mean, that created the conditions for the struggles of the 1950s, 1960s, and so on, which are much more well-known. But the activities of communists, African-American and non-African-American communists, not only in the northern states, but in the southern states, was extremely important in creating the conditions for, let's say, the struggles and victories of later years. And similarly in...
Yes, the Scottsboro Boys.
The Caribbean.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
So, yeah, I was just going to say, in regard to the colonies and publications, that the situation was much more difficult because many of the publications which communists produced were illegal and had to be smuggled into the colonies, of course, by sea, by very difficult routes, by using seafarers in one form or another. Sometimes they were disguised as missionary publications or disguised in some other way, and those who were caught distributing them could often be sentenced to terms of imprisonment. So there were great difficulties involved in producing and distributing this literature outside of countries like the U.S., Britain, and so on. But the communists rose to the task. And in some countries, those who were involved in journalism paid with their lives. And I'm thinking of somebody like André Aliquet, who most people perhaps never heard of, but was the editor of a communist paper in Martinique, which at that time was a French colony in the Caribbean, and was assassinated for his pioneering journalism. So there were all kinds of difficulties and struggles that were waged during that period.
Mm-hmm. Again, it's Dr. Hakim Adi. He's going to be at the different book list via Skype Sunday, 3 o'clock, October the 15th. His book is Pan-Africanism and Communism, the Communist International, Africa and the Diaspora, 1919-1939. Dr. Adi, it's a pleasure talking to you. I look forward to watching you on Sunday.
Well, thanks very much, and thanks for giving me the time and the opportunity to speak to your listeners. Very much appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, a great book. This is CIUT, the Taylor Report, 89.5 FM. I think we have a little music. We'll take a break and...
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.